You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
We are pleased to welcome you to our gathering on immigration policy, highly skilled workers, and U.S. competitiveness and innovation. Foreign residents, students, and entrepreneurs make valuable contributions to the U.S. economy. But what we're going to look at today is what should the U.S. do to capitalize on high-skilled workers, what kind of workers do we wish to attract, and what policy changes should we consider to advance innovation. Today, we have brought together some of our country's top talent on innovation and immigration. They will discuss each of their perspectives on how to keep top foreign students here and also the role of highly skilled workers in the areas of technology and entrepreneurship. We also are putting out a paper this morning by Professor David Hart of George Mason University. I hope each of you picked up a copy as you were coming in. If not, we have copies outside in the hallway, and you're welcome to pick one up on the way out. David is one of our country's most thoughtful writers on innovation and entrepreneurship. He undertook some original work, some survey work on the role of immigrants in innovation and entrepreneurship. And later on the second panel, he will discuss where we are now and where we should go in the future. David, you're going to make some opening comments. I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Daryl. It's my pleasure to welcome you on behalf of the co-sponsor of this event, the Center for Science and Technology Policy at the School of Public Policy at George Mason University. For those of you who aren't familiar with the school, it's grown very big, very fast, and now has about 1,000 students, some of whom should be in the audience, and it's a pleasure to see them. In January, we opened a new building on Fairfax Drive in Arlington, and we're very excited about it. It's a great new facility for teaching and for events like this, and it's also taller than the law school, which is next door. So we're very excited about that, finally emerging from the shadow of the law school, not just figuratively, but also literally. And we hope that we'll be able to draw many of you assembled here in Washington across the river in the coming months and years. But, of course, we're also very pleased to partner with organizations on this side of the river, and especially with Brookings. Daryl has also done work, as many of you know, in the field of immigration and high-skilled migration in particular, and our shared interest, the kind of scholar-to-scholar exchange, is the sort of interaction I think that produces progress in policy research. So very pleased to partner with him for this event. So our purpose today is to give scholars who have active research projects in the area of high-skill immigration, competitiveness, and innovation the chance to share their ideas with you. It's a complicated and somewhat difficult topic. I don't think you'll find any easy answers here. There's certainly not consensus among the panel members today. But it is an issue that's rising in importance. I'm sure many of you saw the President's State of the Union where he mentioned the subject. And that's very gratifying for us working in the field to get that kind of attention. So I hope that you'll leave today with a variety of perspectives and some new ideas, hope you'll continue thinking about this challenging set of issues. And with that, I guess I'm turning it back to Daryl to introduce the first panel.
So our first panel is going to address the subject of the best and brightest in academia and beyond. We're pleased to have as moderator Mitch Waldrop. He is the news feature editor at Nature. Our panelists will include Robert Hamilton of the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, Patrick Gall, who's a postdoctoral research fellow at the Sloan School of Management of MIT, Lindsay Lowell, who's director of policy studies at the Institute for the Study of International Migration at Georgetown University, and then I will be on the panel as well. So if I could ask our moderator and panelists to come up.
Here we go. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming. David asked me to do this in a slightly different order than is listed in the inside of the program. We're going to do it as on the front side of the program. So let's begin with Bob Hamilton. Okay.
As the first speaker, I think we have some logistical challenges here. Get that first one loaded, and I think we'll be ready to go. Okay, good. Good morning. My presentation is focused on doctoral degree attainment by foreign students at U.S. universities in the science and engineering fields. This can be considered as a form of highly skilled migration for the purposes of education. The findings presented here are from a paper co-authored by myself and my two colleagues from George Mason University, Connie McNeely and Wayne Perry, and thanks to the National Science Foundation for their data support. On a personal note, I first became interested in emigration and education in 1989. I just got out of the Marine Corps, and I traveled to Tokyo for a year to study Japanese at a language school. Not too many Westerners in the school, mostly Korean and Chinese students. And none of the students spoke English, so we had a great chance to communicate only Japanese. A tremendous experience, but from this experience, I also gained a great respect for those who leave their friends and family for many years to pursue education in a foreign country. Again, my talk focuses on science and engineering doctoral attainment at U.S. universities, and the time period covered in this study is 1994 to 2005. And doctoral attainment data was collected from foreign students representing 181 nations in the five fields of the five fields that I study are physical sciences, life sciences, engineering, mathematics and computer sciences, and the social and behavioral sciences. During this 12-year period, as the screen shows, the count was 96,466 foreign doctorates in the science and engineering fields at American universities. So let's just say generally 100,000 students during this 12-year time period attained their science and engineering doctorates at American universities. Let's talk about a conceptual framework for the talk this morning. This conceptual framework is offered to help better understand the phenomenon where foreign students travel to the United States for their science and engineering doctoral degrees. First of all, you can visualize a foreign student pipeline from each of the 181 nations to U.S. universities. But also realize that these same pipelines are similar pipelines from these 181 nations also extend to other nations with degree-granting universities such as Australia, Canada, European nations. Therefore, the student pipelines to U.S. universities can be viewed as only one component of a global student migratory network. And further, these student pipelines to the United States appear to be facing growing competition from other nations desiring the best and brightest foreign students of the world to attend their home nation universities. It is also helpful to view home education, that is, kindergarten through 12th grade, and university education in terms of a domestic student education and screening pipeline at work prior to the foreign students coming to the United States. All said, these foreign students who have attained their science and engineering doctorates in the United States have traveled a tough road. First, they had to pass the often challenging domestic education and screening and selection process, and then they had to compete with other foreign students to gain admittance at a U.S. university. Now let's talk about the role of the U.S. universities. As for the U.S. universities, they have played a greater role beyond educating and training foreign science and engineering doctorates. The university should also be viewed as a global recruitment and quality control mechanism that screens and selects the best and the brightest of the world's foreign students for admittance into doctoral programs. It should also be noted that the U.S. taxpayer has not paid for the foreign student kindergarten through 12 and undergraduate university education, in that the home university, in that the home nation picks up the bill for this. So it seems like the United States has gotten a pretty good deal. That is, foreign governments pay to educate their home nation students, and then the U.S. universities have the pick of many of the best and the brightest for their own science and engineering doctoral programs. Now let's talk a little bit about the role of the U.S. government. As for the U.S. government, it highly subsidizes doctoral education to include that for foreign students, the rationale being that there are public benefits resulting from this type of education, and that research, development, and innovation will suffer if students are not offered government incentives to stay in the doctoral pipeline a few years more. The U.S. government also issues student visas, and it should be noted that the student visa pipeline was disrupted due to the 9/11-2001 terrorist attacks, prompting the U.S. Congress to take an interest in helping to establish a new student visa tracking system. Further, foreign doctoral students also appear to benefit universities in a situation similar to on-the-job training, where these foreign students are employed as relatively low-wage, highly skilled research and teaching assistants while they pursue their doctoral degrees. Let me just get a drink of water. Excuse me. Okay. As stated, foreign doctoral attainment at U.S. universities is a case of highly skilled migration. And what seems to have generated policy interest has been the relatively large increase in the presence of foreign doctoral students on U.S. campuses in recent years. For example, as the chart shows, in 1980, there were less than 3,000 foreign science and engineering doctorates attained at American universities. The number exactly is 2,842. As you see, this represented only 16% of the total, meaning that 84% of science and engineering doctorates attained at American U.S. universities in 1980 were attained by U.S. citizens. And as you see the chart, the numbers changed from 1980, 1994, 2005, just three reference points here. In 1994, the numbers increased to almost 7,000, which is 6,950. And by 2005, the numbers exceeded 11,000. And this number increased the foreign student representation to almost 40% of all doctorates attained at American universities. As the next slide shows, it should be noted that there is variation between the five fields, though. For example, this is for 2005. As the chart shows, you see a great foreign domination of the engineering field for doctorates. 61% of all doctorates in engineering in 2005 were attained by foreign students. On the other end of the spectrum, as you see, life sciences. There was only 28% of the doctorates in life sciences were attained by foreign students, meaning 72%, if my math is correct, 72% of all doctorates were attained by U.S. citizens. So you see the variation here. So my point is, if we want to study this phenomenon, let's disaggregate. Let's talk about the five different fields. As you notice also, social and behavioral sciences, only 21% are attained by foreign students, and that means 79% were attained by U.S. citizens. Now, the findings of the study are that four nations dominate in science and engineering doctoral attainment for the years 1994 to 2005. The nations are China, India, South Korea, and Taiwan. If you look at China and India, I think it's fairly apparent that these are large nation population countries. And the reason there are many Chinese and Indian science and engineering doctorates are there's large home nation populations. I think what's interesting is the outliers here are South Korea and Taiwan. With relatively small populations, both of these nations had about 10,000 science and engineering doctorates attained during this time period. So more than why is there so many Chinese and Indian science and engineering doctorates, I think a more interesting question is why there's so many South Korean and Taiwanese doctors during this time period. However, as the time period progressed from 1994 to 2005, you see that the Chinese numbers increased dramatically, and the Indian and South Korean numbers were fairly static, and Taiwanese showed a large decrease. This chart shows the change in Chinese doctoral attainment from 1994 to 2005. If you can't see the screen, let me just talk about this. In engineering field, in 1994, only 136 engineering doctorates were attained by Chinese students. By 2005, the number had increased tenfold, more than tenfold, to a little over 1,500. Tremendous increase. As you see that the share of the Chinese doctorates among the foreign population also increased. As you see in the physical sciences, 36%, Life science is 32%, engineering 39%, and math and computer science 39%. As you also notice, the Chinese representation in social and behavioral science fairly small. I think the idea here is Chinese students are less likely to become economists and social scientists and more likely to become chemists, engineers, and physicists. 2 minutes, very good. I think an interesting question, and let's just talk about engineering one more time. If you look at a 39% share in 2005 for Chinese engineers and a 61% share for all foreign students, what it means in 2005, one out of four doctorates in American universities were attained by Chinese students. And so just a question for me is why are so many engineering doctorates, for the one hand, being attained by foreign students, and so few being attained in the life sciences compared to American U.S. citizens? Okay. In closing, the best and brightest of the world's science and engineering students from emerging market nations like China, India, Russia, and Turkey, for example, will probably become an increasingly prized human resource to be recruited and competed over by developed nations with lower birth rates and decreasing pools of talented young people. The United States should keep this in mind when formulating its own highly skilled migration policy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bob. That was fascinating. Yes, we'll hold Q&A till the end, I believe. So, Patrick, I believe you're next.
So what I would like to do is to talk briefly on a very non-technical manner about two recent research papers I've been working on. And the first one is about Chinese graduate students on U.S. scientific productivity, and that's joint work with Mario Piacentini at the UCD. And then, time permitting, I'll say a few words about another project. So the previous speaker was very helpful in giving a lot of motivation for the paper I'm going to present. Let me show you yet more numbers in the same line. So if you look at the population of PhD students who finish PhD degrees in the United States, and you look at where they took their undergraduate degree, you have this surprise that there are more students that come from Tsinghua University in China or Beijing University than from Cornell and Berkeley. So let's just repeat this because it's quite surprising. If you take someone who finishes a PhD degree from a U.S. university in science and engineering, is more likely to have done his PhD degree at Beijing University than at Berkeley or any other institution. So this, however, is slightly misleading because there are many good U.S. universities and not that many good Chinese universities, and one should keep in mind the figures that were presented earlier, so that the Chinese students are about 15% of students graduating from U.S. universities. It's still quite a large number. Overwhelmingly, Chinese students stay in the U.S. after their PhD degrees, and the kind of corollary of that is that we see a relatively sizable fraction of the science and engineering workforce who is born in China. So about 9% of doctorate holders in U.S. science and engineering applications were born in China as of the 2000 census. And if you take all foreigners together, about 37%. So there's a literature on the contributions of the foreign-born to U.S. science. One of these papers is by Jennifer Hunt, who is on the other panel. And I'm not going to engage into a discussion about exactly the respective contribution of these papers, but what's more interesting is that all these papers came to the same conclusion, which is that migrants make disproportionate contributions to U.S. science and engineering and tend to be more productive on average than natives when looking at the high-skilled scientists and engineers. So in my own work, we have something quite similar, but a bit more specific about the students. And we are asking how the scientific output of the Chinese students during their thesis compared to that of the other students. So we have great data. I'm not going to get into that. We have about 16,000 students graduating from U.S. universities between 1999 and 2008, about 15% of which are Chinese. And when, as for comparisons, we also coded the fellows for the National Science Foundation Graduate Research Fellowship Program. So this is a very prestigious award for U.S. Citizen or permanent resident who wish to pursue doctoral training in U.S. universities. So these are the results. I apologize for the kind of technical table which is coming from the paper itself. So we are looking at productivity during the thesis. And we're seeing how that compares among three groups of students, so the Chinese students, the NSF doctoral fellows, and all the other students. And what we find that in that table, the coefficients can, roughly speaking, be interpreted as percentage differences. So the Chinese students are about 25% to 30% more productive than the other students. And what we do is in column one, we just put all the students together, but in column two, we compare students who are enrolled in the same program. In column three, we compare students who are in the same lab, who have the same advisor. And the results are really quite robust. But you might wonder, you know, is 20 to 25% more papers adjusted for quality during the thesis, is that big or small? And that's why we have the numbers for NSF fellows. And you can see that the type of productivity differential between the Chinese student and the other student is about of the same order of magnitude as that between the NSF fellows and the other students. So in other words, the Chinese students do almost as well as the NSF doctoral fellows, at least to the extent that they are enrolled in the same programs or working with the same advisors. Now, I guess the interesting part is, why is it that the Chinese students do well? And so a preferred story is the following. So in China, there is a large demand for graduate education, but to a large extent cannot be met by Chinese universities, at least until recently. So there is demand for high-quality graduate education, and the students then apply to U.S. PhD programs. However, U.S. admission committees lack familiarity with the Chinese system, with the reference letter writers and so forth, so it's relatively more difficult for a Chinese student to get enrolled in a U.S. PhD program than it is for an American student. And there is evidence that that's the case. But the other part of the story is that if you are in China and you want to do a PhD degree in the U.S., you need to have an undergrad degree from one of the really most prestigious schools to get into U.S. PhD program. This is going to be your passport you were in. And these very best universities in China are extraordinarily selective. So the two best universities in China are Peking University and Tsinghua University. And so about, okay, we can discuss this, but my calculations based upon admission scores and so forth suggest that it's about 30 times more difficult to get into Peking University than it is to get into MIT, for instance. All right, so what we show is that Chinese migrants perform very well in graduate studies in the United States. What is this saying? That the graduate student is the workforce of the modern laboratory. Or the other saying is that the professor is only as good as his best student, because it's a student who is running the experiments and doing all the work in the lab. And so the access to high-quality, talented students enables universities to produce more science. However, there are a number of limitations to this finding. One is that we don't know what happens after the PhD. So we don't know if the Chinese students stay in, so we know that Chinese students stay in the U.S., but we don't know whether they continue to outperform other students. So on the one hand, we know that initial productivity differences tend to continue over the life cycle of scientists and engineers. On the other hand, it could be that Chinese students may lack some of the skills which may be important in postgraduate occupation, so that's one limitation. One point I like I need to emphasize that it does not necessarily follow from the fact that the Chinese students have, or the foreign students generally, have a strong publication performance. It does not follow from the fact that immigration of these students is a good thing for America. And there's a number of possible counterarguments, and the main one is that Chinese and other immigrants may reduce incentives for Americans to engage into scientific careers. For instance, by reducing the wages for postdocs. And just one thought at this point is that there are tools besides immigration policy that could be used to address that concern. And in particular, the number of amount of NSF graduate fellowship could be increased to make scientific careers more attractive for talented Americans without toying with immigration policy. And since I think I have 3 more minutes, let me talk very briefly about my paper on return migration. So generally speaking, we don't know much about mobility choices of foreign scientists and engineers in the U.S. We can know to a certain extent if they stop answering the surveys, but we don't really know what happens to them. We don't know if they just stop answering the survey or if they go back to some country or if they go to a third country. So this paper looked at around 2,000 foreign faculty affiliated with U.S. PhD granting chemistry, biochemistry, and chemical engineering departments. And I'm observing, or should I say, manually reconstructing the career histories over 17 years. And I have an excellent coverage of the underlying population with some caveats. So I'm following the careers of 2,000 faculty, and I look at whether they go back to their home country. And the results are quite striking in the sense that only about 9% of foreign faculty ever return permanently to their home country. So about 91%. So close to 90% stay in the U.S. Moreover, there is virtually no return to India and China, contrary to what you may read in newspapers. It seems like among those who return, there's a kind of negative selection, so at least in the sense that professors who are in good schools are less likely to return to the home country. But I guess the main takeaway here is that despite some recent concerns, the United States remain a very attractive place to do science.
Thank you. Thank you. Lindsay?
Good morning. I'd like to thank David for inviting me and Daryl and the Brookings for hosting this session today and you for having interest in the topic. What I'd like to do today is present some ways of thinking about immigration, skilled immigration, and policy responses. It seems that a lot of our thinking about immigration generally, but certainly about skilled immigration as well, is between, to characterize it, these kind of polar opposites of we need more, they generate unusual and unique productivity and jobs, or we need fewer because they compete and they reduce opportunities for domestic students. I think by the end of this, you'll see I come out with somewhat of a third way of thinking about things. And I want to kind of build a little bit on what you've been hearing here as well. Immigration policy, crudely speaking, has two important things that it accomplishes. One is to set the numbers of migrants that we admit, and the other is to control the quality. Are we really getting the best and the brightest? The numbers thing is fairly easy to understand, the pressures that set, a demand for more or preferably a desire for a lower supply. But the other thing that is happening is globalization. And globalization and really skyrocketing education rates in many source countries is changing the nature of both the student marketplace and the possibilities we have for admitting the best and the brightest. And I want to discuss that a little bit. We've heard the word selectivity here a little bit earlier. That's a kind of a social science concept many of you are familiar with. Selectivity is how do you actually get the best and the brightest? What forces and incentives create a demand for the best and the brightest migrants to come to the United States? I've got 12 minutes, so I'm going to skip some of this. I've got too many overheads. This overheads are too busy. I welcome you to listen to what I'm saying and skip them a little bit. What I want to do here is set up in this slide what I'm going to be discussing briefly in the next three slides, which is, do we have evidence of past shortages in STEM, science and engineering? What evidence do we have of numerical restriction when we look at labor market kinds of outcomes? And what will the future bring? Do we, in fact, admit too few? If you look at this slide, some of you have seen this. The reason you see the bulk of a lot of PhD students from abroad in the U.S. population at the younger ages is because, in fact, we admitted a raft, a lot of skilled migrants in various kinds of STEM fields as well during the latter 1990s. And that was set in place by the 1990 Act and, say, the dot-com boom, which really changed the nature of demand and supply, both the policy at the labor market level. So, in fact, if you look at this, arguably, we certainly admit a lot of doctoral students, but even master's students have in the past, and it shows up in the data. This is foreign students. Now, what you see there is a big dip after 2001, but you also see a big dip after 1981. What's going on? The global economy affects student supply and flows into the United States. And I think arguably the 9/11 effect was pretty minimal, and I have some data that suggests that that was the case. The numbers have again started to respond to the global economy. So the inflow of students from China and India is down over 20%. From India is down 20%, similar to what it was after 9/11. It's the economy. What's really unique about what's going on right now is that there's been a 40% increase in Chinese students in the last couple of years. So Chinese students are coming to the United States in record numbers, and they're such a large group that they're offsetting what would otherwise be a pretty much across-the-board decline in student enrollment in the United States. And think about this, too, in terms of globalization and terms like market share. We know that the U.S. market share of international students fell from about 25 to 20% over the last decade. People say that's terrible. Yet at the same time, the number of students in the United States increased by 100,000, or about 20%. That's a phenomenal rate of increase. If, as is the case, we're seeing a nonlinear growth of foreign students in source countries, for us to regain a third of the international student marketplace like we did 15 years ago would mean a nonlinear growth of foreign students in U.S. institutions. Can we absorb that many students? How would it change the nature of education? And what does it mean to have shortages in STEM? If you look at this box down here, and you can't, like I warned you, read all this stuff in any great detail, wage change in IT and even in natural science has lagged other professions. The person who looks at this, Mr. Lemieux, says it's difficult to understand why an industry with high level of demand generates so few wage gains. So where's the evidence of shortages? And then I play another game. I took a projection, this is a few years old, of BLS. This is the total number of computer scientists and engineers that BLS sees us having at 2017. That's the number employed. I then look at domestic rates of enrollment and just extrapolate them out into the future, and this is what we'd produce on the domestic side. The residual, then, is what we would supply with the foreign-born students and foreign-born skilled migrants, and we would see an increase from 18 to 24% of their share of that particular occupational sector. Now, here's the two things I want you to keep in mind, one of which is that's an increasing share by, you know, almost a third in terms of foreign-born in these occupations. And here's the other thing that's interesting. At our current level of immigration, the numbers that we admit annually, we'll hit that. We were admitting enough foreign students and foreign skilled workers to meet that fairly sizable gain in foreign share of the projected labor market. Now let's talk about globalization and this issue of selectivity a little bit. And I want to talk about a couple of different examples. So we're moving from numbers now to this issue of quality. Well, Nobel laureates are the cream of the crop. They're also a small number. And so people always, when they see this, they dismiss the example because, oh, it's a small number. Well, I agree. But they're symptomatic of a phenomena that I'm talking about. The theory by Hunter et al. Is that when you have big barriers to migration, say as in the Chinese example, then what you do is you create an environment in which you really are highly selective of those who move, who can bear the costs and have the special qualities that make the move across international boundaries pay off. So we know, for example, that the immigrant share of Nobel Prize winners has actually declined. That's the globalization thesis right there. Globalization shrinks labor markets, lowers the cost of mobility, and therefore is less selective. You certainly see it here. But you see it in another remarkable way, too. That is, immigrant share of the PhD labor market in STEM has actually increased markedly, while at the same time the share of the Nobel Prize winners has decreased. So there's a decreasing selectivity in at least two ways that you can see there. Are there other ways in which you can see this? Well, this is an ugly graph, I realize. It was better when I did it last night. And what we've got here is three different fields. And the point is that this is the ratio of educated with bachelor's or above, because this is what the data permits me to do, educated life science, life and physical natural scientists. They're about, 35% more likely to have a college education than natives. That's out here, back in 1950. But their ratio of educational advantage has been going down. Same thing with engineering, with a little blip. And then life science, quite different, and that's fascinating. But remember, life science is information technology. But remember, information technology is a bit of an odd bird because about a little under 10% of IT workers don't even have a high school degree in among the domestic labor force. So what does it mean to be more educated in that context? Earnings ratios, they've gone down, again, except for IT, which is strange. But basically, over time, what this is what we call it in social sciences, deselectivity. Globalization shrinks labor markets, decreases the selectivity of international migrants, and you see it in terms of their relative education to the domestic labor force and in terms of their relative earnings. You're going to hear from, I think, Dr. Hunt and others, and I think you've also heard here earlier, there's a lot of good evidence that foreign, both workers and students are highly productive. Are they uniquely productive is a question. One thing you also hear about, and we may hear from a little bit about David, is their rate of startups. And depending on the data you get, you can get somewhat different stories about the relative productivity of immigrants. But what I want to look at very quickly is this idea of corporate leadership using just national level data, simple data. And what we can see is that at a national level in the United States, about 12% of STEM workers in information and communication technology industries are self-employed. And a large share, a fairly remarkable share, are also CEO business owners. In Silicon Valley, which you probably can't see too well unless you look through Patrick's head here, is quite a bit higher and fairly remarkable, actually, in Silicon Valley in terms of foreign, basically directorship of corporations. Yet their share of the labor force is higher. So where am I going? I'm doing good. I want to return to the themes of numbers and quality. Numbers you can set in different ways. Quality is also set by the marketplace, but it's also uniquely set by policy. And there are three different kinds of philosophies, I think, generally. One in three are the ones I opened the presentation with. One is you just set large numbers, and the market will self-regulate, make the policy process painless, not simply to facilitate skilled migration or student migration, but to make it pretty painless. Talk to anybody in a business HR department. Hiring people is not painless. It's not clear that admitting migrants need be less painful than just doing good hiring. The 2006 bill that I mentioned here, Senate 26111, would have increased skilled migration by over fivefold with escalators for H-1Bs. But it would have set the system pretty much the same. Number increasing in that way, I argue, will have an adverse effect on quality selection. On the bottom end, there's an argument that we have an oversupply of highly skilled workers. The third way, which is number two, is what I suggest people also consider, which is balancing numbers and quality. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Lindsay. And finally, we have Daryl.
Thank you, Mitch. What I'd like to do is focus on the policy aspects of immigration, specifically as it relates to higher education, building in part on the very interesting papers and empirical analysis that has been presented here. But I want to start with some brief remarks on my immigration book, Brain Gain, Rethinking U.S. Immigration Policy, because what I do in that book is argue that we need immigration reform in order to boost long-term economic development and productivity. And I actually put a picture of Albert Einstein on the cover of the book just to remind all of us about the many contributions immigrants have made to American life over the years. We all know that Intel was founded by a Hungarian immigrant. Google was co-founded by a Russian immigrant. Yahoo was established by someone born in Taiwan, and eBay started by someone from France. What would the American economy look like today if Intel was a Hungarian company, Google was based in Russia, Yahoo was a Taiwanese company, and eBay was French? I argue these are not isolated stories. Studies have found that many Silicon Valley companies had a foreign-born founder or co-founder. Immigrants have made vital contributions to our economy. Just this morning, we've heard very interesting examples of the role of international students in terms of productivity. We've seen in Robert's paper just the rising number of foreign students over the last 20 years. Patrick documented the higher productivity. Lindsay had some very interesting nuances to the story in terms of worker shortages broken down by field, and we see some of the interesting contrast between the IT field versus some of the other areas. And then later on the second panel, you'll hear more from David about the role of immigrants and students in establishing startups. So I think that in a lot of respects, there is evidence about the contributions that immigrants make. But yet, when you look at our politics, our politicians are paralyzed by this subject. And it's kind of ironic that it's been difficult for our political leaders to address immigration, even though virtually everybody dislikes some aspect of the status quo. And I think the problem with the immigration area is that people perceive the costs as being high while the benefits are low. In that situation, no big surprise, the policy area becomes radioactive for politicians. It becomes hard to resolve. There's a lot of emotion. There are many myths and false information surrounding that discussion. So one of the reasons why we wanted to put on this forum today was to inject some facts into a very emotional and polarizing topic. And it's not like everybody is in agreement on what the facts are, but I think it is both interesting and important that there be some factual basis to these discussions so that we're not just making decisions based on opinions, ideology, or false beliefs. In my book, I make a number of policy recommendations about various aspects, but I want to focus specifically on the international student aspect because that's what this panel is really focused on. I found it very interesting in Robert's paper that he found that 38% of doctoral students today are coming from abroad. But yet, very few of these people actually have an opportunity to stay here. One of the suggestions I make in my book, and others have made the same suggestion, for example, Mayor Michael Bloomberg has talked about this as well, is automatic green cards for foreign graduates of American Science and Technology PhD programs. And we're not talking about a large number, because if you look at Robert's paper, it's not a huge number that is required. But in terms of the quality, the possibilities for innovation and the opportunities for entrepreneurship, I would argue that the economic benefits are huge. Certainly, when you look at the information technology field, the dot-com field, and the number of high-tech companies that have been started by immigrants or foreign students who came to the United States to enter PhD programs, there certainly are a number of examples where these individuals have made a dramatic improvement. Now, we could trust the market, and there certainly are some policy mechanisms that are in place to match up the supply and demand in terms of the need we have for science, technology, engineering, and math students. But we need to keep in mind that the job opportunities are starting to change. You know, it used to be that we just needed math students for higher education to train future mathematicians and so on. But in recent years, we have seen the world of finance start to hire mathematicians. They're starting to take some of the people that used to go into higher education, become college professors, the hedge fund companies, the private equity firms, the risk assessment individuals are now starting to drain off some of these individuals. So I would be very interested in seeing Lindsay's paper projecting into the future that when you start to see greater demand across a variety of different areas, not just traditionally science and technology area for people with PhDs in this area, is that mismatch going to become larger? Is it actually going to become a national crisis? So for that reason, I think we need to become more proactive as a nation. We do need to think about some of the policy actions designed to fulfill fields where there are likely to be shortages. And if you take the results of David's paper seriously, if we think about the entrepreneurship aspects and the startup aspects, you know, these are the people who are going to come. They're going to innovate. They're going to create jobs. They're going to build businesses. They're going to be major parts of the U.S. economy. So I just think we need to get more strategic in thinking about our need for high-skilled workers and the role that international students play in that area. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you all. Have I forgotten anybody? I don't think so. Right, well, we have kept our time admirably. We're ahead of time, so we'll have lots of opportunity for Q&A. I'd like to start, if I might use the moderator's prerogative. We've, of course, been hearing about the immigrants and the contribution they make, but we also regularly hear anguished reports about the state, poor state of STEM education in the United States, actually every country seems to moan about that. And the implicit implication there is always, without usually being discussed, it's just an assumption that we need more. We need more people in these fields. And yet, Lindsay, you were talking about, well, maybe there isn't a supply problem. We seem to have enough. We seem to have foreign students clamoring to come in. So how do you, this is a vague question, but how do you balance this immigration issue, this immigration policy debate with these calls for improving our domestic supply of scientists and engineers?
Yeah, am I on? There we go. Good. Thank you. I mean, this is not an easy nut to crack. On the domestic side, work I've done with Hal Salzman, a colleague at Rutgers, certainly suggests that some of the simplistic ways in which we think there's a lack of supply in the pipeline don't measure up. About a third of incoming freshmen over the last three decades have said, I want to study in STEM fields. So there's no drop in interest. In terms of those who are capable, high school math scores within the United States are actually up. If you look at international tests, we don't often do that well. But then remember, there's maybe 5, 6, 7 million STEM workers out of a labor force of over 150 million. So everything has a distribution. How many highly skilled people, how many in the top percent of the SAT scores do you need to supply that labor market? Now, Daryl brings up a more interesting issue, I think. And at its extreme, it gets into an issue of science citizenry. and this is an old thing, it's been around for a century or more, the idea that to really be an adequate member of a modern society, you better understand science. At the extreme, it's hard to know how to deal with that. I think it's true, but how much science do you need to know? If you look at financial industry, a large share of STEM workers in STEM occupations there, but a small sector overall, so it's not siphoning everybody off. Or another way to look at it, there's maybe 15 million people in the United States with a STEM education and maybe a third of that in STEM jobs. So clearly some of them are working outside of STEM, and that's probably a good thing, but how many more do you need? And that's a hard nut to crack. Did that answer?
Yep. Sure.
Just one comment. I believe Salzman also points out that when compared to foreign students, U.S. citizens tend to leave the pipeline earlier. And the sense is that talented Americans don't stick around to get their doctoral degrees. They greater tendency to enter the workforce. And so at a certain point, when you compare the foreign doctoral students with the U.S. citizen doctoral students, you have two different populations, and that they and I don't want to misquote or misrepresent his views, but he seems to suggest that the best and the brightest of the Americans tend to leave the pipeline earlier, whereas the most talented of the foreign students tend to stick around and get their doctorates.
Right.
That's not right?
Okay, please correct me.
Okay. Yeah, Hal and I did some work with about several longitudinal data sets and looked at progression through the pipeline from high school into college and then into the labor force from the 70s through the 1990s and early part of the last decade. And what we found is that the change or the rate of attrition at each level in the pipeline, high school into college, bachelor's, master's, PhD, labor market, 3 years out, labor market, 5-6 years out, the transition rates hadn't changed much overall, except for, interestingly, and we didn't really break it out by nativity, in the 1990s, there seems to be a dip in retention in STEM jobs and STEM higher degrees among the top quintile performers. And that's an odd outcome, and we don't really know what's going on. So something did happen in the 1990s among the top performers.
I believe there are microphones coming around. Yes, I believe you're first, and then the gentleman back there.
Thank you. I'm Peggy Orchowski. I'm the congressional correspondent for the Hispanic Outlook on Higher Education, and I write a lot about immigration and have written a book on immigration and the American dream. Being a journalist, I have questions for each of you, so please bear with me. But Patrick, I wonder if you have studied about clustering in various universities, that foreign students of certain geographic areas, even certain parts of India, would tend to cluster in one university around, say, a scholar from that university. Lindsay, I wanted to ask you more about that, the wages tending to reduce as the foreign student population. I haven't heard that 90% before. IIE usually says 70% stay, so 90%, that's really huge. Daryl, I wanted to ask you about the numbers. You said there's few, but as you were saying, that something like the foreign student numbers actually hit the peak, 600,000. It hit it over that peak a couple of years ago, and now it's close to 700,000. The majority of those students on foreign student visas here, of the 700,000, majority are graduate students. The majority of those are in STEM. So we're probably talking 250,000 people. And if those are given, if they're given automatic green cards, I would think that is a significant number. So could you talk about the number? And then, you know, they're not all Nobel laureates and they're all not going to start at Google. So we're talking quality of 250,000 plus. And if it's retroactive, we're talking maybe a million people. So, and I'd also like in the politics, of course, the whole other politics of immigration, what I cover a lot is on the low-skill workers. And I think, Daryl, you and I were talking at one point that this is a zero-sum game. If we're letting in, giving green cards in to foreign students that will maybe at the expense of, say, extended family visas. And I think there's a lot in the Hispanic caucus particularly who are against that. So, okay. Four questions.
Patrick?
Right. So we definitely observe clustering of, let's say, Chinese students in certain universities and in certain labs. So universities, I think at NYU, more than 50% of PhD graduates from the chemistry department are Chinese. At Berkeley, it's less than 5%. If you look at labs, labs that are headed by a Chinese professor have about 40% Chinese students, which is much higher than the population. And then you have kind of the intriguing fact that you had labs, which, by the way, are doing extremely well, for instance, at Stanford in nanotechnology, where you have one famous Chinese professor, and all his lab is almost entirely Chinese. So it's an interesting phenomenon, but it's not exactly clear what we take from that.
Yeah, again, STEM immigrants in general are better educated than natives, so their nominal earnings tend to be higher. The point I was trying to make is that if you use wages as another way of looking at selectivity, that earnings premium has decreased over the last half a century kind of thing. And there's different ways you might want to think about this. That was a simple point. That was a new set of slides I produced. I always like to do something new in my presentations. I was also doing some simple regressions on wage differentials, ceteris paribus, and it turns out that ceteris paribus, of course, immigrants don't have differential earnings in STEM fields than natives. Jennifer Hunt's not here. That has a heavy caveat by, again, class of admission. So it gets back to the policy. Policy is a screening mechanism, and the class of admission makes a big difference in earnings outcomes for migrants. So policy matters. I think I'm going to skip the stay rate question.
Peggy had a couple of interesting questions just in terms of the numbers, and if we kind of gave everybody, every foreign student who got a PhD in a STEM field an automatic green card, would that just overrun the system? And I guess I would argue that, you know, when you break down the number of foreign students who are here today, you know, you're taking out the undergraduates, you're taking out the graduate students in non-STEM fields, and then you're taking out the people who drop out along the way. So I think the numbers do start to drop. But then the question is, let's say the number is still a big number, you know, we don't have the best device for picking, you know, who is going to be the Sergey Brin who's going to end up starting Google or an equivalent type of company. And so you need to admit numbers sufficient to raise the probability of actually being able to find those people and keep them here. So the spirit of that proposal is basically designed to expand the field beyond what we have today, because today we're kind of at the opposite end of the spectrum where there are so few foreign students who really have an opportunity to stay here unless they already have found a job and are able to qualify for a visa through their employer. And then on the zero-sum game between low and high-skilled workers, it becomes a zero-sum game only if we stick with the current number in terms of the visas, either permanent or temporary visas that we provide. In that situation, then there is tension between the high skill and the low skilled area. But if we ever reach the point where we increase those numbers, it becomes much less of a zero-sum game.
Yeah, I just want to, again, throw some of these policy issues out there because they're tricky. There's something called the Staple Act, this idea that you give somebody, you staple a green card into a foreign graduate's degree, and they get to stay in the United States. I have the following issue with that. If you look at the Australian experience where they essentially gave landed status to graduates, it created a decade of problems for them because it created the wrong incentive structure. What happened is, I hope this doesn't surprise you, the students came to Australia to get landed status, not to study. So the incentive structure that you build is very important, and greater numbers will not necessarily yield you greater results. You have to design the incentive structure right. Francis is here, I noticed. I think lengthening the OPT for STEM workers is a right way to go in terms of setting an incentive structure for research and study, which is what we want our students to be.
The microphone is coming. And please, just one question per person.
My name is David North. I'm with a small think tank called the Center for Immigration Studies down the street from us. My question to this all-male panel is, why hasn't anybody mentioned the tension between essentially male overseas PhD students and residents of this country who are female? I also would note in passing, and I think this is correct, that in the area where the percentage of foreign-born PhDs is smallest, which is the life sciences, I think is also the area in which there are more women percentage-wise than in the other four fields. And I wondered if one of you might speak to the gender issue. Thank you.
Thank you, sir, for asking that question. Connie McNeely, George Mason, and I are beginning a study on the gender issue, and I think it is fascinating. What we like to do is to take a look at the demographics of, as a presentation I gave, just break it down by gender and to see if there's any association. Do the richer nations tend to have larger or smaller representations in the male or female populations? But the question that I asked, is there a large untapped population of talented women out there that are not being recruited to U.S. universities? So give me about a year and I'll get back to you on that.
Okay, there. And then we'll start on the back.
Mark Brodsky, retired physicist. I want to ask a little bit about your data about the entrepreneurship. You gave these examples of Intel and Google. There's two types of immigrants involved in that. One that comes here to study, and one that came here for political reasons, either with a visa not necessarily to study, but for political asylum. And both those examples, Intel and Google, are the latter, I think.
Response?
I think you have to look at your data to separate that out that effect from the policy implications of your encouragement.
Okay. Anybody like to comment on that? Okay, in that case, I'm back there. Yes.
My name is Jennifer Miller. I'm a doctoral candidate at UNC Chapel Hill. And this question is for David Hart. You had mentioned the intriguing counterfactual of what if Intel were a Hungarian company and Google were a Russian company. But do we know that that is the alternative outcome? Are perhaps these entrepreneurial success stories due to some of our other institutions around entrepreneurship in the U.S.? And might that counterfactual be that we would have waited a few more years before those companies were founded, and then they would have been U.S. companies by the next person who grasped a similar idea?
Good question. Counterfactuals are always hard to test by definition, but I think it is apparent that the United States is facing growing competition for entrepreneurship, especially in the IT area. I mean, the new president of Russia has talked a lot about trying to create a Russian Silicon Valley, so they are very much devoted to training their students and keeping them in Russia and building the companies there. We see the same phenomena in a number of different Asian countries. So I guess the worry I would have is when you look to the future, with so many other countries seeing the power of information technology as well as life sciences, the link between those areas and economic prosperity and job creation, they are now basically trying to keep those students home so that they can get the benefits of those contributions. So that would be the thing I would worry about as we move to the future.
Okay, I believe, yes, in that same row.
Hello. My name is Lauren Lipchek. I'm working on my master's in public policy at Mason, and I'm also an immigration paralegal, so it's kind of a great intersection of those two interests. I'm curious if you think that, particularly for Indian and Chinese nationals, if there's any added incentive because of the visa regression in the EB-2 category to stay in the pipeline through PhD and to be extra productive with their scholarly work to try to attain the EB-1 category.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I think you're exactly right, and that could be part of the story. But it's a bit difficult to distinguish this from the fact that the type of students who come into the United States are different from native in some other respect, right?
Yeah, I'd only add that the EB-1 is typically for older, you know, more productive scientists, so I'm not sure it would apply to the student model too readily.
Josh Meehan with the Global Innovation Forum. I have a question regarding a very small snippet from Mr. Gall's presentation where you talked about that there was some data that indicated that a higher presence of immigrants being interested in science and engineering possibly meant that there were fewer Americans that were actually just interested in pursuing it to that level. And so maybe this is for anybody who wants to answer this. What is the best incentive that people seem to respond to? Is it the wonder of science? Is that why people come here and continue to get their PhDs and stick around? Is it actually for cash? Because someone actually said that that a decrease in wages could be a reason why Americans are less interested. And, of course, finance is draining lots of our mathematicians. So what is it that we need to instill to actually get people here, again, interested in science and to pursue it to that kind of extent that's important? Thanks.
If you look at surveys of immigrants, they'll tell you the reason they come to study in the United States is the quality of the institutions, but also the love of science. If you, like a good social economist, kind of look at the data, what we find is that economic incentives really matter to the flow of migrants across different countries. There's a really fascinating piece recently that looked at the availability of H-1B slots and its impact on SAT performance among foreign students, and it has a positive impact. The story there is that there's a labor market motive as well. Creating the right incentive structure is a difficult thing to do. One of the things that's clear in a Sputnik moment is you can't simply gin up the supply side. You have to have a demand side as well. If you don't stimulate the demand side, you don't get the wage growth. If you don't get the wage growth, you don't attract the domestic labor force. And you probably, in the long run, don't have a favorable impact on the immigrant quality either.
Hi, I'm Takar. I'm an intern for Immigration Equality. I have a question about you guys. Some of you mentioned about statistics of how many people are getting PhD degrees and how many people going back to their countries. Now, if they, would you say like that's really related to like personal reasons, like family related? And if we create a system where they can stay in the States with their family, how much of an impact would that have to American economy?
Yeah, that's a very important question. If we did, say, do the automatic green cards for PhD graduates in the science and technology field, how many would actually want to take advantage of that as opposed to going home? I think in the past, more would have availed themselves of the opportunity to stay here just because of the opportunities. But I think moving forward, this is where the United States is facing more competition, that those home countries are now making a major effort to bring those students back, and the economic opportunities that are going to be available to those students, especially those coming from Asian countries, is going to be huge. We all have seen the estimates that by 2050, China is going to have a larger economy than the United States. And so I think, you know, when that individual student is making that decision, do they stay in the United States or do they go home? Obviously, there are a lot of factors that go into it in terms of family reasons, the situation in the home country, as well as their perceptions about economic opportunity.
Hi, Audrey Singer from Brookings. I have a question about demand and supply and how to measure these things when we're talking about high-skilled workers overall. How do we understand the demand for workers? How do we measure it? And what do we know about international, you know, the international selection of workers into those streams? So it's a bigger question about our economy. We're going through a restructuring right now. What do we know from the past? How do we understand demand at this point? Big question, I realize. But I'm looking at Lindsay, right?
Well, we don't. But we do look at certain kinds of indicators. We look at levels of unemployment, which in STEM tends to be low. We look at wage change, which has been low. And if demand for lawyers can increase wages 30-40% over a long period of time, why is it not changing STEM earnings at all? In fact, why does STEM earnings tend to lag other professions? Do we need that many lawyers? I mean, I like lawyers, don't get me wrong, but I mean, you know, how many do you need? What's the relative demand? We don't know. But we do know one thing fairly clearly in research, which is that supply will respond to wages. And so if employers put their money where their mouth is, they will stimulate a supply. And so in a simple way, I think that's one way you look at it. The more complex answer is, you know, we're looking at wise commissions to do this stuff. The Migration Advisory Committee in the UK is an interesting example. Using multiple ways of trying to determine demand. And the standard critique I get to my kind of presentation is, well, how about petroleum engineering? It's a booming field. Yes, it is. So it doesn't really match up with what I'm talking about engineering generally. And so to get at that fine level of detail, which is what employers care about, which is what the economy cares about, is what, you know, Darrell Carroll's about when he's talking about certain kinds of mathematical aptitudes bleeding out into non-STEM occupations. It takes a really finely disciplined kind of approach. My approach is probably not to try to over fine-tune things, but to set the appropriate incentive structures and let the market work it out.
Hello, I'm Yavana Turna with the Interactivity Foundation, and I'm starting a project on human migration. My question is for everybody on the panel, and what aspect of this topic that we are talking about today you think would be the most useful for the U.S. public to discuss? Thank you.
I mean, that's a very good question, and obviously it's so good that we're having difficulty answering it. But I guess I would answer by saying the problem I have with public discussions in the immigration area in general is just how emotional it is and not linked to facts. I mean, I often like to contrast our discussions about immigration with our discussions about Social Security. Now, Social Security also is seen as a radioactive issue. You know, it's often described as a third rail. Politicians can't really address it. But the difference in the Social Security area is there tends to be an agreement on basic facts. And then people argue, like cats and dogs, over the interpretation of the facts, what the policy ramifications are, how we should address things, and so on. The problem in the immigration area is not only are we arguing over things, we're arguing over the basic facts. So what we tried to do this morning was just try and provide some empirical evidence to address these things. So what I think the public needs to understand is what the facts are of the situation. And it's not like, you know, there's always going to be a complete consensus on those facts, but I think that's what distinguishes the immigration area from a lot of other areas and the reason why it's been so difficult for our country to address.
Just, I think, for the general public, I think it's useful to say that there's a lot of talented people in the world. And if the United States or any other nation has use for those folks, then what's the problem? If you see you study some type of the migratory movement, a student might get his doctoral degree in the United States from China and India, and they have contacts in China and India, and some of the research shows that their contacts, both in the U.S. and China, or U.S. and Taiwan, it's a win-win situation. for example, a Taiwanese company might be started by a Taiwanese doctorate out of Silicon Valley. Jobs are created in San Francisco Bay Area. Maybe jobs are created in Taiwan, and maybe there's an offshore somewhere else, Mexico, whatever. I think this is the story that should be told is this is not a zero-sum game. There's great potential for win-win. When you educate people, when talented people are able to go where there are jobs, then good things may happen. And I think the challenge for the researchers is to quantify that and make the case that this is more than – I mean, I'm saying that, but the challenge now is to give evidence to show how this does create jobs and makes lives better for both the United States and other nations.
I hesitate to say this because it's not normal for somebody in education. I'm not sure the public needs to know more. I mean, I often used to think that was the case. But consider this. The GMF just did a survey, international survey, and they asked people in the United States what proportion of the United States population is foreign-born. They said about a third. Well, that's double the actual percentage. And they said, well, what proportion of foreign-born are undocumented illegal residents? And they said about half. And I said, boy, they really don't know what they're talking about, right? You know. And then the commentator at the National Press Club made a very interesting point. He says, well, they may not be knowledgeable, but maybe they're wise. So, for example, about a third of the U.S. population is foreign-born and their children. So what do you mean by immigrant? And at least half of those who arrived in the last decade are unauthorized. The number of unauthorized migrants on a yearly basis exceeded legal migration for a good part of the last decade. And so how much more do we need to educate, in what way? I think, from my presentation, what I'd like the public to understand is that there's a trade-off between numbers and quality, and setting incentive structures is a very difficult thing. Possibly, and there may be a few here that agree with me, Congress should be less involved in doing these things, and we should have more of a model like Canada or Australia, where you have responsive, dynamic, bureaucratic control of these things with congressional oversight, so you get the incentive structures correct.
James Tsang, we have a system that mixes H-1B and EB. Would any of the panelists like to talk about how these should fit together, and in fact, whether there's an optimal mix of the two?
I think we need a lot of creative thinking. You know, MPI has recommended a provisional visa, which would basically do away with the system we've got, so that if one gets a provisional visa, you automatically progress to permanent status. There's a lot of smarts to that. If we were to stay with the current system, clearly the H-1B numbers exceed the funnel at the other end into the EB, and even if you do away with the per-country caps, you're not going to get around that problem. The numbers just don't wash. So if you're going to stay with the current system, I would say the H-1B either needs to be smaller or probably smaller and, I would say, more temporary, a three-year max. So you would change radically to make it a true temporary. And I think if you did that and maybe expanded the EB, which would be a very good idea, I think you would be in a much better situation.
Zolt Knotts, George Mason University. The panel seems to imply that there's a U.S. problem. We need immigrants to grow our country, to innovate, to be successful. And I really wonder if that's true. I mean, because what you're implying, there's something really wrong that we want to fix, and we want to fix it with immigration. And I'm not sure if the panel actually believes that. Or is immigration really some other bigger issue about American exceptionalism that we sort of don't understand? But this economic issue, I'm not sure that there's something really wrong that we need to fix with immigration.
I guess I would answer that by focusing on innovation. And certainly the president in his State of the Union address talked about the importance of innovation for long-term prosperity and job creation. So I'm interested in the immigration angle because of the tie between immigration and innovation. I think there are links between the two at various levels that we've talked about in terms of startups, contributions to knowledge and so on. So I think that's the crucial link. The United States has done very well on innovation in the past. I think the worry that I have is going forward, are we going to do as well? And if we don't do as well, you know, what is that going to mean for our economy over the next 10, 20, and 30 years?
And I'm afraid this will have to be our last question.
I'm Ken Jacobson, a recently released Democratic congressional staffer. In talking about the incentive structure, I wonder if one of the problems isn't the marked trend to send both productive capacity and high-skilled jobs to other countries in recent decades, and maybe compounded now by what we've seen in the last couple of years, a marked lack of investment, particularly at home. Companies are sitting on a lot of cash. I wonder what that what message that sends to people here about whether their skills are going to be applicable here with places like GE and Intel doing so much research abroad. The foreign students are already from somewhere else, and they come here, so presumably they are willing to go somewhere else or they're willing to go home. Americans, I think, tend to believe that we're the number one country on earth, and so why would they want to go someplace else? So what I'm wondering about is in the absence, and also when it comes to innovation, it seems that for a number of years, at least from what I've heard about in Silicon Valley, if you have a startup plan and part of the work is not being done in Asia, you can't even get in to talk to somebody. So my question is, in the absence of a clear future regarding either productive capacity in the United States or commitment to corporate research in the United States, are we going to have a great deal of success attracting young people who are American citizens into scientific careers?
Well, all I can say is before I came to Brookings 2 years ago, I taught at Brown University. And when you go into the PhD programs in many of the math, engineering, and science fields, the clear majority, in some departments it's up to two-thirds or three-quarters, are foreign students. And so, you know, that's the crisis that some people are perceiving about STEM education in the United States, that American students are no longer going into those fields. And so, if you combine that with lack of opportunity for foreign students to get the degrees and then to stay here, that becomes a crisis. I mean, we can solve that problem in several different ways, but if American students are not studying the STEM fields and we're not providing very many opportunities for the foreign students who are interested in STEM areas to stay here, that has the makings of a crisis.
Yeah. And one thing Dale and I certainly do agree on, which is that the number of foreign graduates coming out of our institutions isn't so large that it's going to tip things usually one way or the other. It's an important resource. Most of us do believe we benefit from migrants. And at the least, we know that the system is running in mud. And so it should be fixed in some way so we don't have these bottlenecks and that we have in so many different levels. But I guess if you have to really simplify Paradri's question, can you resolve these innovation issues, what Bhagwati calls the American fear of being a diminished giant? Can you address these innovation demands and these fears by simply ginning up the supply side? And I think arguably no. You've got to have heavy investments in R&D. What triggered the Sputnik moment was investments in military. Would we go that way now? So in other words, I think you got to work on the demand side as well as the supply. We can over-focus on the student issues altogether. And the domestic pipeline, I think, will respond if the appropriate incentives are there.
Okay, I wish we had more time. This has obviously been a very lively and productive discussion. I want to thank you all and invite you back for the next session.
Okay, everybody, please move to your seats. We're getting ready to introduce the second group of speakers. And very good. I'm Kevin Finner, and I'm the editor of Issues in Science and Technology at the National Academy of Sciences, and I will be the moderator for the panel discussion for the second session, and I will be introducing the speakers. And this time the panel is going to be sitting down below, so that and then they'll all come up here at the end of the presentations. We're going to start out with Jeanne Batalova, who is a policy analyst with the Migration Policy Institute, and rather than wasting long time on backgrounds and so on, we're just going to jump right in. So, Sean.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Jeanne Batalova, and I'm from the Migration Policy Institute, a research organization that deals and studies in depth various aspects of migration and immigrant integration in the United States and other countries. And it's really a great pleasure to be here and to share the work that my colleagues at MPI have been involved in the last few years. I'm going to talk about something that the first panel didn't touch on, and that is what happens to immigrants once they come to the United States and they do have college education, and then they find themselves in the situation when their skills, knowledge, education is not utilized properly. The phenomenon is called brain waste, and you'll hear a lot about it today. So how many of us run into an immigrant taxi driver who could write a complicated computer program with his eyes closed, or perhaps overheard a medical interpreter who used to be a physician in her home country, or hired a contract help who apparently has an engineering degree from abroad? How many skilled immigrants in this country who find themselves either unemployed or employed in jobs for which they are substantially overqualified? Whose concern should it be when skilled immigrants in the United States, instead of becoming Google and Yahoo-like entrepreneurs, find that their skills, education, and drives are underutilized in the labor market? What are the opportunities for the public and private actors to address such brain waste? These are the questions that I'd like you to explore with me today. In our efforts to quantify brain waste, we focused on college-educated immigrants ages 24 and older who were either unemployed or employed in jobs that require no more than moderate on-the-job training. So these are the examples would be construction laborers, file clerks, cab drivers, nannies, parking lot attendants, and so on and so forth. Well, what we found was quite disturbing in our opinion. There are more than 1.5 million college-educated immigrants who were unemployed or working in unskilled jobs as of 2009. 21% of college-educated immigrants, so one in five, were working in unskilled jobs, and that's compared to 17% of the college-educated U.S. workers. Another 22% of immigrants were in what we call semi-skilled jobs, so these are jobs that require long-term on-the-job training, perhaps an associate degree, but less than college education that the immigrants have. And the examples would be carpenters, electricians, massage therapists. We also found that, well, the brain waste is a reality. That's our conclusion. What we also found is that some groups of immigrants are more prone to face brain waste. we found that 43% of recently arrived Latin American immigrants, and recently arrived are those who came in the last 10 years, and 36% of African foreign educated immigrants were working in unskilled jobs. Longer residence in the United States typically is associated with improved outcomes. However, we found that almost a bit more than a third of Latin Americans who've been here for at least 10 years were still working in low-end occupations. The next slide is based on our analysis of job quality of legal permanent residents. It's a survey. The data from the National Immigrant Survey that was conducted in 2003, and unfortunately, that's the latest data that we have available. But so here we look at green card holders and those who had obtained their degrees abroad, and we are able to track the job quality from the time they left the United States, so their first job, their last job abroad, their first job in the U.S., and their current job. And I'd like you to pay attention to three patterns. First of all, immigrants whose admission was based on employment visas saw little change in their job quality over time. For all other admission categories, there was a decline following the migration and subsequent rise in job quality. The decline was deeper for those who came as refugees or diversity immigrants, the green card diversity lottery, than for family immigrants, who often can count on relatives and assisting them in the integration process. But also let's look at the status adjusters versus new arrivals. Very quickly, status adjusters are immigrants who receive their green cards while they're in the United States, after spending typically some time in the United States on a variety of temporary visas. And what's important is that status adjusters have better relative outcomes over time than their new arrival counterparts, in part owing greater exposure and experience in the U.S. labor market. Adjusting to a new labor market is not an easy task, and many highly skilled immigrants experience a sharp drop in occupational status when they arrive. What are the main risk factors? We found that lacking English skills was one of the biggest barriers. And let me emphasize that we are not talking only about English vocabulary or proper grammar, but the ability to communicate effectively in the work environment that many newcomers lack. Having just a foreign degree, our analysis shows that those with U.S. degrees are three times more likely to be in skilled jobs. U.S. experience, that's what U.S. employers want, demand, and really rely on in their assessment in whom to hire. Those who entered on non-employment-based visas, those who came with a country of origin or region of origin matters. Lacking U.S. professional and social networks is a huge barrier. But there are also institutional factors that absolutely have to be addressed. Immigrants often face substantial difficulties in recognizing their foreign earned credentials and work experiences. They lack, as I mentioned, professional networks, mentors, and opportunities to learn how things are done in the field of study. So I have, okay, four more minutes. Just very quickly about other institutional barriers that we found in our research that has been again and again huge obstacles. Lack of state-specific and occupation-specific information about steps that are needed to pursue former careers. Gatekeepers. We have two major gatekeepers, professional associations that set rules state by state that often with protectionist instincts, as well as employers who often lack knowledge and cultural competences in evaluating and hiring internationally trained professionals. Shortage of quality programs that are available to newcomers that target work and language training as well as job search and interviewing skills. So given what we heard in the previous session, we already know that highly skilled immigration is important for innovation, competitiveness, creativity, academic excellence, expansion of knowledge, and so on and so forth. So I'm not going to talk about why brain waste is an important issue to address, even when the economic recovery is slow. Instead, I'd like to share what we at MPI think is a two-pronged approach in dealing with, in addressing the brain waste. It's immigrant integration and policies with regard to admission. So in terms of immigrant integration, the examples of other countries, and again, I'm a person who always looks at what are other people are doing to get the best ideas. The examples of Canada and Australia show that the importance of multi-stakeholder approach. So companies, employers can do a lot at their level by incorporating language training, for instance, in their in-house communications skills training. States have huge role in making sure that brain waste and human capital are not wasted. I'm sorry, brain and human capital are not wasted. So states, for example, can partner up with other stakeholders and provide support for mentorship and internship programs similar to what Canadian federal and provincial governments are already doing on a large scale. They can provide occupation-specific and guidelines that are clear and up-to-date on how immigrants can have their foreign earned credentials and work experiences recognized. They can spur the development of effective bridge programs that serve both immigrants and employers. And there are important spillover benefits to other groups of workers, for example, those returning from the armed forces, women returning to work, or former inmates. And at the national level, a lot can be done in terms of funding innovative and successful programs and information sharing. But we also talk about we also think about policies that can be done at the immigrant admission. Someone already mentioned the provisional visas, which will redefine who is hired, when is hired, and what are the opportunities people have after getting experience, after both prospective workers and employers test waters, and the provisional visas will give rights to work, but also will give an opportunity to sponsor themselves for permanent residence afterwards. And the last one, I know that I'm running out of time, is our idea of having to bring, we absolutely need to bring flexibility into how immigration level and numbers and types of visas are set when the economy is changing like this and we're still in the gridlock over undocumented immigration and nothing is moving. So having a commission, an independent commission on labor markets and immigration would allow us to bring flexibility and transparency and analysis, something along the lines that other countries are already doing. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Fortunately, our next speaker comes from outside our borders. This is Jennifer Hunt, a professor in the Department of Economics at McGill University.
Thank you very much. I'm going to return to the topic of skilled immigrants and innovation, and I'll talk a little bit about entrepreneurship as well in the context of the United States. And I'm going to begin with some theoretical remarks before telling you some of the results of my own research. So how would we, in fact, expect skilled immigration to increase innovation? And firstly, why do we care about innovation? Obviously, because it increases productivity growth, which is the driver of economic growth. And why would skilled immigrants help this? Now, one thing I want you to think about is that one way it might help is simply by making the population bigger. If ideas can be spread costlessly over as many people as you like, then the more people you have, the more ideas are likely to pop up, and the richer per capita a country will be. The thing we usually think about, on the other hand, is that immigrants may themselves be more innovative than the native-born. An alternative, which is perhaps slightly less talked about, is that even if they're not more innovative, perhaps they're better at some skill that's complementary to innovation, like entrepreneurship. Now, why would skilled immigrants have these superior capacities? There are two options. One is that they have some natural ability that's actually better, like some entrepreneurial spirit or talent. The other is, although they're not mutually exclusive, is that the immigrants are better educated or perhaps more specialized in relevant fields of study. How would these things in turn come about? One is what we call the self-selection mechanism. The sorts of people who want to come to the United States have these attributes. And again, not mutually exclusive. The other possibility is that these are the people that our visa system actually lets come to the United States. So is the analysis this simple? I want to bring up a couple of theoretical points here related to the importance or otherwise of where skilled immigrants actually live. And first I want to think about the amount of innovation that's actually done in the whole world. So step back from the United States for a bit to think about the big picture. Does it actually matter where the immigrants live? Are we just talking about reshuffling where the innovation occurs? Well, immigrants might actually be more innovative. Their innovative capacity might be increased by moving to the U.S. Or even if their innovative capacity is not, their capacity to commercialize the innovation may be. Are these conditions actually fulfilled? I can't cite you a lot of academic studies showing that definitively, but I think that we think that probably both of these things are fulfilled, these conditions, so that most probably by bringing somebody very able to the U.S., that they're going to actually be able to realize their potential better. But I can't actually prove that to you. Now, let's actually think about a different issue. A lot of the discourse in the media and in politics seems to consider innovation to be some sort of sports competition where winning is what matters, and if you come second, it's just a disaster, and the better your opponent is, the worse off you are. So let's take the example of Intel. So Daryl mentioned earlier, imagine what the U.S. would be like if Intel were in Hungary. The discourse in the media and politics is something that seems to say Intel in Hungary is worse for the U.S. than there being no Intel at all. Now, obviously that is wrong. Perhaps an even better outcome is Intel in the U.S., but if Intel were in Hungary, that would still be benefiting everyone in the U.S. a lot. So let's remember that and ask the question, in fact, does it make any difference? The answer actually is yes. There are academic studies that show that innovation done in the United States is more beneficial to the U.S. than innovation abroad. But just bear in mind that the innovation abroad is beneficial as well. It's just a question of which is more beneficial. Okay, so I think there's evidence that all of these conditions I've talked about is true, that bringing people to the U.S. actually improves their capacity for innovation and commercialization, and that that is somewhat better for the U.S. than having those people do their work abroad. Okay. Let's just think about two other possibilities. So at the very beginning, I was talking about how the immigrants themselves might be extremely capable. Their contribution to the U.S. might be even bigger than their individual productivity if they actually improve the performance of the native-born. So I work better when my colleagues are better, and so immigrants might actually improve the capacities of the native-born. Now, on the other hand, immigrants might actually contribute less than you would think by looking at their own productivity, because perhaps, as has been mentioned a few times, they're discouraging the native-born from going into innovative fields. And here I'm going to actually present you some evidence of which is true. Okay. So now I'm going to go on and talk about my own research, some of which is done with Marjolaine Gauthier-Loisel, who's a student at Princeton. And there are two parts to this. One, we're really focusing on the individual immigrants and their productivity compared to the natives. And what are we looking at? We look at patenting, and I'm going to present the results to you specifically of people commercializing patents. Publishing frequently is another outcome we're going to look at that was actually cited by an earlier speaker. And I'm also going to look at the probability of founding a company that grows very fast at the beginning. And that part of the analysis does not take into account the positive spillovers immigrants might have on natives or their potential dissuasive effects. But the second part does. The second part is narrower in scope. It only looks at patenting, but it looks at the causal effect of skilled immigration on patenting per capita. And that's going to include these spillover effects. Okay. The data I'm going to use for the first part are from something called the National Survey of College Graduates from 2003. And then for the second part, I'm going to be using many decades of census data and data from the U.S. Trademark and Patent Office. So here's the first set of results. So these are from individuals. And I'm going to start off by looking at wages, even though that isn't directly related to what we're talking about. But I'm starting off with wages because labor economists usually think of the wage as capturing that individual's productivity, again, without any spillovers, but their overall productivity. And I'm going to focus here on the first column at first. What this number tells you is that, and remember that the sample here, everyone has at least a college degree. This tells you that the immigrants earn 2.9% more than natives. So they're, crudely speaking, we can say they're 2.9% more productive. Then the next line is looking at, all the next questions refer to the preceding 5 years. And the first question is whether you've licensed or commercialized any patent. Not that common an outcome amongst natives. It's 0.6% of people who had. And what this number says is amongst immigrants, it's 0.7% more. So in other words, it's more than double. Okay, more than double as likely to have commercialized or licensed a patent. And then the next measure I look at is whether you've published a lot of papers. I use a cutoff just because of what the distribution looks like of more than six. 3.6% of natives have done so. An additional 3.1% of immigrants have done so. So it's almost double. Okay. And then the final outcome is quite rare. Because of the nature of the data, I can only look at not if you simply started a firm, but if you started a firm in the last 5 years that by the end had more than 10 workers, that's a very fast growth. So these unusually successful companies, 0.6% of natives have done so, an additional 0.18% of immigrants. So the gap here is not as big. It's about one-third more likely for the immigrants. Now, what I do in the second column is I try to look at what explains this superior performance? And I do that by comparing similar natives and immigrants. And by similar, what I really mean is here I'm comparing immigrants and natives with the same level of education and the same field of study. And when you do that, you find that compared to similar natives, the immigrants actually earn 8% less. This is a rather well-known result that I won't linger on that seems to be closely related to how old you are when you arrive in the U.S. and language ability. What's very interesting is that the results are different for the other more technology-related outcomes. So you do, however, fully explain why the immigrants are better at patenting by comparing people. Here the key thing actually is the field of study of the highest degree. The immigrants are concentrated in science and engineering, and that explains why they're twice as likely to patent. Okay, so you get a zero here. Higher publishing rates, you actually still get a little advantage of the immigrants when you compare similar immigrants and natives, but it's one-tenth the size. That's mainly so the reason for the superiority here, the double as likely to publish frequently, is because of higher education and more and fields of study of highest degree where people publish more. And then starting firms, though, actually doesn't make any difference comparing similar immigrants and natives. Now, in my view, it's the first column that captures the actual contribution of the immigrants to the U.S., but this one is useful for understanding what it is, namely higher education and the field of study of highest degree that allows that superiority. Okay, now I'm going to tell you briefly about the paper where I look at the impact of skilled immigration on patenting per capita. Just very quickly, this is from 1940 to 2000, what patents per capita look like. There's a big increase starting in the 80s. Okay. This is what the share of immigrants as a share of skilled workers looks like. This is immigrants as a share of college degree holders, goes up to 3.5% by 2000. And what I find is that indeed skilled immigration increases patenting per capita. I'll give you some actual numbers. So in the 90s, patents per capita rose 63%. The share of immigrants amongst the college population grew from 2.2% to 3.5% in that time. And there's a range of results, depends exactly how you specify things, but that increase in immigrants increased patenting per capita between 12 and 21%. So immigrants are responsible for between one-sixth and one-third of that big increase in patenting per capita in the 90s. So to conclude, because of higher education and different fields of study, skilled immigrants patent more, publish more, start more companies than natives, and they raise patenting per capita. And this is where I just want to remind you that in this paper, it actually takes into account spillover effects. And what I can actually do is to compare whether the impact I find here is greater or less than you would expect from the individual contribution of the immigrants. And I find it's actually slightly more, which suggests that actually immigrants are increasing the productivity of the natives and rather than discouraging them. Of course, there may be a few who are discouraged and more who are encouraged, but the net effect seems to be to actually increase the performance of the natives. And then finally, you can do a back-of-the-envelope calculation, the impact of these immigrants who arrived in the 1990s on innovation, the effect of innovation in turn on GDP per capita, and you can work out that because of the inflow that there was of college immigrants in the 1990s to the U.S., that GDP per capita was between 1.4 and 2.4% higher in the 90s than it would otherwise have been. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next speaker will be Ron Hira, an associate professor of public policy at Rochester Institute of Technology.
I want to thank David and Daryl for inviting me to present here, and I also want to thank the Economic Policy Institute for helping to support some of this research. I'm going to talk about some policy issues. And the title of my talk is Bridge to Immigration or Cheap Temporary Labor. The H-1B and L-1 visas are a source of both cheap temporary labor as well as permanent immigration. So let me hit the key points here. First, H-1B and L-1 visas are temporary work visas. They're not the same thing as green cards or legal permanent residence. And we heard a little bit about the green card discussion this morning, some terminology that some of you might know, EB, employment-based, EB1, EB2, EB3. There's different categories of green cards and getting green cards through employment-based. Having said that, H-1B and L-1 visas are temporary, but they are also dual intent. And what that means is that employers have the option of applying for legal permanent residence for those workers. Those workers can't self-petition. Of course, they could try to go through the diversity lottery or go through some other means, but from an employment-based means, they generally do not have that ability. And that in this paper, what I'll show you is that some employers, in fact, use the H-1B and L-1 visas as a bridge to permanent immigration, as a bridge to a green card, while others are using it simply for labor mobility. And this is part of what's happened over the last decade in terms of globalization and offshoring, and I'll tie those together. And this is important from a policy perspective because we often, at least in the public discussion, conflate the two, that an H-1B is the same thing as a green card and that our policy levers don't distinguish between the two, between a temporary work visa and legal permanent residence. The H-1B and L-1 visas also account for a lot of workers. It's about a million or so workers. We actually don't know how many, and this is one of the problems in the discussion also, is that DHS, the government, really isn't collecting data and it doesn't know exactly what's going on with these visa holders. I would also talk about some of the loopholes that make the visas attractive for cheaper indentured labor, and also tie in how these loopholes are fueling offshoring. What you'll see is that, in fact, the top employers are offshore outsourcing firms. So let me go through very quickly some of the gaping loopholes that we have in the program. There's really four that I would identify as being most important. One big myth is that there's a labor market test. In fact, there is no labor market test for H-1B or L-1 visas. Employers do not have to look for American workers before hiring H-1Bs or Ls. And in fact, they can replace American workers with H-1B and L-1 visas, and this isn't just a theoretical thing. It's been reported in various press accounts that major companies like Pfizer, Wachovia, when it was taking TARP money, IBM and Siemens have actually had enforced their American workers to train for and replacements on H-1B and L-1 visas. The upshot is that there's no shortage necessary here to bring in these workers. They can also legally pay below market wages, and we know this in a variety of different ways, but the most obvious way is that, in fact, some employers of H-1B workers have told the GAO, yes, we hire H-1Bs sometimes because they will take lower, less than market wages. And, in fact, the GAO found that 54% are paid skill level one wages. These aren't super high wages. These are the 17th percentile for those particular occupations in those locations. So a lot of them are being brought in at essentially entry-level wages. Another problem with the program, both programs, is that employers hold a visa and control the legal permanent residence opportunities. So as I said, the workers can't self-petition, and because of the nature, and we talked a little bit about this earlier today, about the small number of green cards that are there relative to the large number of H-1B and the uncapped L-1s, that actually creates a very imbalanced relationship, and you've got a large number of people who are on these temporary work visas that are waiting in long green card queues, and they're stuck not only to that employer, but even within that job. And so they're really indentured in a lot of ways. And there's been very little government oversight. The system integrity mostly depends on whistleblowers, and that's really not the best way to run things, particularly when if a temporary worker is terminated, they actually have to leave the country right away. So it really discourages them from going through that. Okay, so let me get into some data here. This is the top H-1B employers, what I've done is added up these top employers from FY07, FY08, FY09 data, and what the upshot of it is that 7 of the 10 top employers have significant offshoring. They're offshoring firms, and this is kind of the who's who of the offshore outsourcing industry, mostly based in India, Infosys, Wipro, Satyam. So if we're going to talk about who are the beneficiaries of the H-1B program, one has to say that the offshore outsourcing industry has been a huge beneficiary. 7 of the top 10 employers beneficiaries of H-1Bs are actually offshoring firms. And then what I've done is looked at to what extent these serve as a conduit to permanent immigration. So to what extent do H-1Bs and L-1s serve as a bridge to immigration? And I'm just going to show you one chart here, which is the H-1B data in the interest of time. And what I've done is taken those top 10 employers and I've reshuffled them a little bit based on what I call immigration yield. And what I've done is looked at the green card applications that each of these employers have filed on behalf of their H-1B workers over that three-year period, and divide it by the number of H-1Bs, and what I get is an immigration yield. So that, just to clarify here, Tata Consultancy applied for zero green cards but received 2,368 H-1Bs. That would be a 0% yield, whereas if you look at Microsoft, they applied for about 67% of the number of H-1Bs they got. Now, this isn't a perfect measure, but it gives you an indication of how these employers are using these programs in very different ways. And we have to have a more nuanced discussion, I think, about thinking about policy and policy levers and criteria that we use when we look at the impacts of these types of programs, high-skill immigration. If the goals are really to bring the best and brightest and keep them here, then we need to look at this kind of data, think about how we disaggregate some of the uses and the criteria that's being used. And you can see there's some clustering there at the top. Companies that might surprise you, like Accenture, apply for very, very few green card applications, whereas they're getting quite a few H-1Bs. IBM, similarly. And part of what's going on there is they're getting pressure basically to adopt the offshore outsourcing business model. And I'll show you another chart in just a minute that will explain this. But you've got U.S. companies that have essentially been pushed in the direction of adopting the same model that an Infosys or a Satium plays. So this chart here is from 2005. And the reason I pulled this out is this is kind of a tipping point for the IT services offshore outsourcing business where it really took off. And what this shows, and I'll just point out, I've got the four of the top IT services companies, two based in India, two based in the U.S., and I'll focus on Infosys, the top Indian one, and EDS, which was the top U.S. one until it was bought out by Hewlett-Packard. And what you see here is the pressure from Wall Street. Market cap is the market capitalization, so this is the total value of the company as priced out if you took its stock price and multiplied by the number of outstanding shares. If you and I wanted to take Infosys private back in 2005, we would have to come up with $20 billion. If we wanted to take like EDS private, it would cost about $12.5 billion. So why was Infosys priced so much higher by the market, even though it had much lower sales, about a 20th of the sales? The reason is pretty simple, is because their profit margins were much higher. The reason their profit margins were much higher is partly because they were doing the work offshore, but also because they had advantages by bringing in on-site labor at lower costs on H-1Bs and L-1 visas. So, in fact, government policy tilted the field in favor of that kind of business model. And to give you some sense of companies like Infosys really don't hire very many Americans. They have a very small share. And the companies themselves have actually talked about this quite a bit. Here I pull out a quote from the CIO, the Chief Information Officer of Wipro, told Business Week this back in 2007, how they use the H-1B program. They bring about 1,000 new temporary workers to the U.S. each year, while 1,000 rotate back to India to serve clients. So what it does is it serves as a training ground where you bring in workers to learn the jobs and then move them overseas. These policies also disadvantage companies that are hiring American workers or try to hire American workers. And this quote is from an interesting guy, Neeraj Gupta, who's the CEO of Systems in Motion, which is actually a U.S. rural source-based company trying to hire Americans. But he's kind of interesting because he's actually a former executive of one of the offshore outsourcing companies. And his quote is, "The widespread abuse of current work visa laws, be it B-1, H-1B, or L-1 programs, that allow companies to bring in cheap labor from other countries to replace an American labor pool is extremely damaging to our business because it creates artificial pressure on prices and consequently wages of an equally qualified local workforce." So you've got someone who knows the system inside and out because he's been an executive in one of those companies and how it's harming now his business as he tries to hire American workers. And you hear this also from trade groups like the National Association of Computer Consulting Businesses, now known as TechServe Alliance, where they testify before Congress about the L-1 and the opportunities there. In the case of the L-1 visa, there's no wage floor, so there's huge wage arbitrage opportunities, where they testify that, in fact, their clients or their companies were being undercut by 30 to 40% in terms of their billing rates. So let me conclude with some discussion on policy reform, and I'm sure we'll talk about this in a lot more detail during the Q&A. But it seems to me that it's pretty clear that the current system is harming American workers, students, and companies, as well as foreign workers, as they become tethered to not just an employer, but to a specific job waiting for 6, 8, or 10 years for their permanent residence. And I think it's right for incumbent U.S. STEM workers to question these kind of government policies, whether they're being undercut or not. And that's important for a few reasons, not only because it hurts them. You could say, well, it helps the public welfare, maybe at their expense. But if STEM really does matter, and you think that you want to encourage U.S. domestic supply into STEM, these are the best ambassadors to that next generation. It's the incumbent workers who will go out and work with young people to say these are great careers and great professions you should come into. So in terms of my recommendations, I'd say we should close these four loopholes, which I don't think should be controversial. One is that we should implement effective labor market tests. You should look for American workers. There should be some demonstration of some kind of need there. That those foreign workers should be paid market wages at least, and that you should increase the portability of visas and have a clear and rapid path to permanent residence, and that we should conduct regular audits of these programs. We also need a lot more sunshine on these programs, particularly the L-1 visas. We have very little data and very little information on what's going on, particularly in terms of wages. You can hire a typical IT worker or engineer in India for $7,000 a year, so you can imagine that kind of wage arbitrage when you have no wage floor at all. So we really don't know what's going on there. Secretary of Labor Ray Marshall has recommended a Foreign Worker Adjustment Commission. I know Migration Policy Institute's worked on these things. And I'll leave it with this last one and just say that I don't think that trade policy should circumvent immigration policy. One aspect that hasn't been discussed enough is the intersection of trade and immigration policy. Trade agreements are increasingly having these kinds of immigration type of provisions in them as low-cost countries want to see immigration as a non-tariff barrier to trade, that their comparative advantage is low-cost, high-skilled workers, and the barrier to trade is moving their workers into the high-cost countries. Thank you.
All right, and our final speaker is the person who's most responsible for bringing this entire session together, and that is David Hart from George Mason University.
Thank you, Kevin, and thank you all for staying. It's been a long morning, and I know we have some discussion to go, and I look forward to that. So my work is on a relatively small but important slice of this subject, and I want to acknowledge my co-author, Zoltan Ach, who is here. I put his name in parentheses only because he shouldn't be associated with anything I might say in the Q&A, especially, and he can speak for himself, I'm sure, if he disagrees with me on any of the points. This work builds on Zoltan's prior work, and we focus in on a particularly important population of firms. These are firms that have doubled in size in a four-year period. And his earlier work suggests that these firms are responsible basically for all of the economic growth in the economy and employment growth as well. They're an interesting group of firms. They need to be studied more. They're not all startups, but most of them are pretty young. And they're not all in the high-tech sector. In fact, they're distributed very broadly across sectors. But there is some reason to think that high-tech firms are more important than other firms. So in our study, we focus particularly on these high-impact, high-tech firms, with the idea being that perhaps this is a point of leverage for accelerating economic growth in some fashion. I should mention, reference this paper that Daryl mentioned at the beginning of the talk. We have a policy briefing that we're releasing today through Brookings, and then that's related to broader peer-reviewed work in the academic literature. And so I'll allude to that, and you may want to look up some of the more fine details in that paper or in the published work. Okay, so we did a survey of these companies, and there were about 25,000 firms in our population. That is, these are the high-tech firms that had doubled in that four-year period from 2002 to 2006. And we basically called them up and asked them a short series of questions, and we had about 1,300 responses. And the reason we kept it short is because that's the way you get a reasonably high survey response rate. Of course, the disadvantage is we only know a little bit about these companies. So there's a lot more detailed questions we'd like to know about them, but we don't know the answers. We did do some follow-up interviews with a small group of companies, and that shed some qualitative light on it, but it's difficult to draw final conclusions from that small set of case studies. But they're complementary. And our basic finding is that about a sixth of these firms had at least one foreign-born founder, and I was calculating from Jenny's number. Her number was around a quarter, I think, if we extrapolate out. And we have other studies in this field. Quarter is kind of the high end. We're sort of on the low end, and there's a variety of reasons for that, different populations that got studied, different ways of defining the population. But my view, and I think Zoltan's view, is that either way you look at it, it's a sizable share of these companies. Many of companies are founded by more than one person, so if we look at the population of founders rather than the population of companies, so we take each founder individually, the number goes down a little bit. About 13% of the founders of these companies were foreign-born. So you notice I'm shifting back and forth between the language foreign-born and immigrant, and I want to clarify that. So someone in U.S. law doesn't become an immigrant until they get a green card, and the reason that I think it's justified to use that term here is that most of these founders have been here a long time. Most of them, in fact, are naturalized citizens, many of them are highly educated. And these characteristics are not surprising because we're only looking at companies where they've been successful, right? They doubled in size in a four-year period. And, in fact, in our case studies, our little case studies, we found a surprising proportion of people had founded previous companies. So they're serial entrepreneurs, which also is a success factor that's well known to be associated with entrepreneurship. So this is the kind of profile of these founders. I think the thing that strikes people most when they look at our paper, the thing I've gotten the most feedback on, is just where these people come from. They come from all over the place. And in the very back of the paper, you can find the table of 55 different countries that are represented in this population. Here's a little bit of detail on education. We know that these foreign-born founders, so here the dark bars are the foreign-born founders or immigrant founders, and the light bars are the native-born. So you can see they're far more likely to have a higher education, to have a graduate education. And I think that's because, as Jenny said, education is a major gateway for highly skilled people to come to the U.S. And also there are opportunities for people to start high-tech firms, natives to start high-tech firms before they get to graduate school. So Bill Gates and Paul Allen being very famous examples, college dropouts who started Microsoft. Obviously, that option isn't open for someone who just arrives in the U.S. as a graduate student. Now, the real difficult question here is, are these folks complementary to native-born, or is there some kind of crowding out? And unfortunately, and I think all of us in the field feel this is unfortunate, there is no definitive answer to this question. Do the founders make the firms, or in a sense, does the environment make the firm? We get a little bit of leverage on that by comparing those firms that have at least one foreign-born founder with those that were native-founded. And what we find is that they're very similar unless we take out – this is if we control for education. If we take education out, actually the foreign-born firms perform better. The firms founded by foreign-born founders perform better. This is a question of interpretation, again. To what extent is their success due to their individual characteristics, again, as Jenny alluded to, or does it have to do with the environment in which these firms are being founded? And if a native-born person had had that same education, would they have founded a similar kind of firm? One difference that we do find is that we ask the question, does your firm have a strategic relationship with a firm in a foreign country? And we do find a difference between the firms that have at least one foreign-born founder and those only founded by native-born. Again, question of interpretation. Is this a vehicle for outsourcing jobs that would have otherwise stayed in the United States, or is this a business strategy that is really essential to the firm survival? Question I don't think we have a definitive answer to, but is interesting to think about. Another finding that's not going to talk about a lot, but that struck us as we looked at the data, was that the foreign-born founders were more likely to team up with people who might be considered outsiders in the U.S. context, that is, minorities, U.S. minorities and women, compared to their white native-born counterparts. So that's an interesting finding. There's not a lot of these firms, so I think you have to be very, very careful in doing much with that, but it's an interesting proposition for future research. So the bottom line, and this has gone into in more detail in the paper, I don't think we can rule out the crowding out hypothesis, but if we put that finding in what we find in conjunction with the work of Jenny and others, our inclination is to view the foreign-born founders as complementary to the native-born founders. But I would absolutely admit that there is some interpretation and extrapolation required to get to the policy implications. Okay, so let me turn now in the last piece of the talk to the policy issues. The first thing I want to say is we need to embed this in a broader set of policy themes, and that we're talking about long-term policy, not any kind of help for the recession that's going on right now. And the idea is that maybe we can expand that big population of high-impact firms, and that that might help the economy. Can we do that? I don't know. I think the administration is starting to engage in an experiment that would try to answer that question, and I hope that they will move that forward. Then what's the role of founders in leading to that outcome? I think it's necessary, probably, but not sufficient. And the question was raised earlier about the counterfactual. What happens if we take these foreign-born founders out of the equation? I think certainly if there's not demand, and Lindsay alluded to this, if there's not demand for the products of high-tech companies and high-impact companies, then expanding the number of people who might found them is not going to lead to more companies. But in conjunction with a broader policy that deals with all aspects of the environment for high-impact and high-tech companies, I think that having immigrants who have these characteristics is probably a positive contribution. And that's obviously something we're going to discuss now in the panel. So how would you do that? I put not so new ideas as I've gotten into the immigration field, so I come into this from science and technology policy. There are no new ideas in the immigration policy, as far as I can tell. Every idea has been thought of, debated, recycled. People said it's paralyzed. It's been paralyzed a long time. Anyway, so my not so new ideas, there are three of them. The first one, and I think this is the one that has the most leverage, is to just try to deal with the backlog of people who are already here waiting for their green cards. There's not a lot of data on this, but there is a paper that suggests about 500,000 so-called employment principals, that is people not counting families, but 500,000 people just waiting in line for their green card and doing, you know, various things that it takes to extend their stay in the U.S. Most of these people are from a small number of countries, India and China. Some of the categories were alluded to earlier. EB2, that is employment-based, second category, includes professionals with advanced degrees. So if you're from India and you have an advanced degree, the immigration system is basically processing people from the middle of 2006, so about a four-and-a-half-year backlog for that. EB3 professionals with bachelor's degrees or skilled workers, so that's a much broader group. There, if you're from India and you've applied for a green card in February of 2002, you're now at the top of the priority list. So we're talking about, you know, 6, 8, 10 years for many people. And my view is this is just accommodating reality. These people are here. They're working. Let's free them up from being tied to their employer. So that's idea number one. Second idea, I think, again, some of the previous speakers have mentioned something like this, is to try to address the immigration pathway for students. Students have to figure out how to get employed. There is a pathway for them to get employed through so-called OPT, optional practical training, so it's possible for students to stay and look for a job. But when that period expires, they have to have an employer who's ready to sponsor them, and that may be difficult. And then, obviously, they have to get through the green card process like everybody else. So I'm in favor of trying to link these statuses together, but I think it's important to build in the employment piece as well as the student piece, as opposed to those who would say that we should staple the green card to the diploma. As a representative of higher education, I can tell you there's a lot of creativity in higher education, and there would be universities that would recruit on the basis of attractiveness to the green card as opposed to other kinds of things that you might want to recruit students for. So I think there's some need to temper that idea with an employment element. And then the third one, and this one I think is much more difficult to implement, but it hasn't been mentioned today, so I'm glad I have it on my list, is the idea of creating some kind of a point system. And here the immigration system would pick people on the basis of some set of characteristics, educational qualifications, language qualifications, and so on. And this is in place in a number of countries, Australia and Canada most prominently. And it was contemplated in the 2007 bill. For picking high-tech, high-impact entrepreneurs, I think that's a much more difficult proposition. We're talking about a tiny fraction of the population, and it's very difficult to observe those qualities like risk-taking, like some kind of outlook on seeking opportunities that you might want to identify these people. So I think that's difficult to do, but it would be worth talking about and thinking about it. So wrap up. My time is over. I don't want to exaggerate the importance of high-tech entrepreneurs. It's a very small slice of this population, but I think it is a consideration that'd be worth thinking about as we debate this broader question of competitiveness, innovation, and high-skill immigration. And again, thanks for coming. I'm looking forward to the discussion.
All right. Excuse me. I'm going to ask a couple of questions. First, to just I think try to focus the discussion a little bit. One of the things I realize in listening to all these presentations is that the presentations there were
we're confronting layers upon layers of questions. For 25 years, I've been worrying about the fundamental question about how can we even provide evidence that investments in research and development lead to innovation, that innovation leads to growth in the economy, and the growth in the economy is benefiting the country largely. And I've had no success in answering that question satisfactorily. So we have lots of questions. We have to look at where innovation comes from, although people in the science and technology community hate to talk about it. It's possible that the reason that the United States is so innovative is not because we have great scientists and engineers, but that we have great financial managers on Wall Street who can provide the capital where it's needed, when it's needed, or that we have terrific lawyers who are able to negotiate contracts, property rights, and so on that make it possible for these great ideas to become profitable businesses. So we're not going to try to resolve all of those questions. But we have a tremendous amount of information here, and I'm going to try to focus a couple of questions on where we have data and where we've raised specific questions that I think we might be able to help answer. So I was going to start with if we can even agree that it's a good thing to have highly skilled immigrants come into the United States, can we say that without also deciding how it is we allow them to come in? So, for instance, we talked about many of them come here. They're well-educated, but they can't get the right degrees. So I was going to ask Jean when she was listening to Ron's talk about the way many people, the system they have to work through in order to find jobs, how big a problem is that? How much of the problem that you see of people not being able to find adequate jobs with the training they have, how much of that is caused by the way that we regulate, particularly the temporary work visas?
By the way, I found all the presentations been very insightful, and I do agree with a number of with the loopholes and that Ron described and how they contribute to this mismatch in opportunities that domestic and foreign workers have. But in our work on brain waste, we found that the people who are affected the most are not so much those who come through temporary and employment-based routes, but rather those who come through family reunification or under humanitarian protection. on the other hand, those who do come through H-1B, L-1, F-1 student visas, their employment opportunities are usually substantially better.
Also, I think a related, the follow-up question is, when you look at the differences, the sort of brain waste, as you call it, do we know how common this is in other countries? Is the United States particularly bad at wasting the skills of its population?
Canada and Australia have done tremendous amount of research on the issue, and they were, in fact, the pioneers in the field identifying that it is a problem. Both countries have points. Based system, and they the government actively selects who's supposed to come based on their human capital. Yet they found that immigrants who arrive, they can't find jobs, and their outcomes are rather poor. So both countries have done work and not only identified the extent of brain waste, but also quantified it and found that there are substantial economic costs at the national and provincial levels. So we are somewhat in the beginning on in doing this work, and we MPI try to quantify it for the first time in the United States. But in Canada and Australia, it's been recognized as a policy issue of national priority, and substantial resources, investments, and coordination of many stakeholders have been done to address this.
Okay. Ron, I wanted to ask you, you complained a lot about the way, particularly Wipro and Infosys, treat their workers. Just to give us a little bit more concrete understanding, what exactly is the nature of their business? And also, when we're thinking about the larger effect of having skilled workers, how do companies like this, how do you understand them in terms of what they do for the overall economic benefit for the United States and for global productivity?
Sure. Just to clarify, I think from their perspective, probably from the workers' perspectives who work for Wipro and emphasis that they feel like they're being treated well because their opportunities are actually better than the alternative, which would be working abroad. In fact, I have cousins who are much happier working for these large firms. So that's one aspect. So they're choosing those positions. And I think this then raises a larger aspect of how does this impact not only the U.S. companies who are benefiting by getting lower cost services. Generally, these companies work in IT services and BPO. And you'll have the U.S. companies, the U.S. multinationals, who are very happy to get those lower costs and, in fact, advocate on behalf of a more liberalized H-1B and L-1 visa program, including putting them into trade agreements and all. Now, the question is that good for the U.S. economy? How does that affect American workers who are competing? We could, as some economists do, believe that everybody who comes in is complementary, no matter what their wages and working conditions are. But I don't think that that's the case. I think it does have an impact in a couple of different ways. One, in terms of affecting Americans' wages and working conditions, putting pressure on there, but also in speeding up offshoring. I showed you the types of profit margins that these companies have. They're really transferring knowledge and capabilities overseas. And what they're doing is they're creating a competitive landscape where an IBM, an Accenture, an EDS, the major U.S. companies, are adopting that offshoring model much faster than they normally would have without those kinds of policies. And so we hear from The Economist magazine that IBM now has more workers in India than they do in the U.S. Accenture has had more workers in India than the U.S. since 2007. They have over 50,000 workers in India, less than 35,000 here in the U.S., and we wonder about job creation in the U.S. It's not just entrepreneurs that matter. It does matter that you have that human capital employed even in large companies here. That next generation of entrepreneurs also comes out of those large companies. And we can look at history. EDS, Ross Perot was an IBM salesman. Cisco, John Chambers was an IBM salesman, and so on and so forth. So I think there's lots of we need a more – a nuanced discussion about those impacts. It's good for some of these U.S. companies. Is it good for the country? I mean, this is goes back to the Bob Reich, who is us.
Jennifer, since you've tried to identify some of the, how do we look at benefits? How do we see how this affects the sort of larger economic forces? Is there any way to sort of ferret out the differences, the types of innovation, the types of companies, the types of changes we are seeing in the way we are using this, this talent in determining what the overall benefits are?
That's a good question, but a hard question, but it does tie into a few things that I did want to say and that you actually brought up in your initial remarks. When I began the paper, for example, to look at the effect of skilled immigrants on patenting, why did I actually pick patenting? Because it's measurable, not necessarily because I thought it was the biggest contribution of immigrants. But if you want to look at the contribution of immigrants to the finance industry, for example, or to the management consulting industry, you can't really measure it. And so we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that science and engineering are not the only places that, that people in general and immigrants in particular can contribute to productivity growth in the U.S., but it is a little bit easier to measure than contributions in other areas. In terms of the benefits, let me talk about what Ron was just talking about. There's something a little bit strange about the literature that talks about offshoring. Let's think about the literature that looks at trade in goods. Of course, when you're looking at the effect of trade, you look at both imports and exports when you're thinking about goods. If you're thinking about trade and services, one would imagine one would do the same thing. But importing services, that's what offshoring is, and exporting services is onshoring. And yet, I don't think I've ever seen a paper about onshoring to the U.S., except about three papers that show that the value of onshoring to the U.S. is about equal to the value of offshoring. So it makes as little sense to study only offshoring as it does to study only imports of goods. You have to look at the other side as well. So you can't say just is offshoring bad. Is the idea really that the U.S. would somehow never offshore anything ever but would continue to onshore an equal value? And there's really no change in policy that you can make to any economy that improves everyone's well-being. There's always going to be winners and losers. And so if you think of trade and services, one assumes, but I've never seen a study, that the onshoring is of jobs of higher skill level than the ones that are offshored. And so presumably this whole process does increase inequality, but there's certainly no reason to think that it decreases employment.
Okay.
Can I get to just that point?
30 seconds, all right.
Yeah, as a number of blue ribbon panels have shown, the National Academy of Public Administration, Tim Sturgeon's group at MIT, we don't measure services, particularly when it comes to trade, very well. In fact, there's huge data gaps, and so there isn't a way to talk about onshoring, offshoring in terms of the trade data itself and services.
Okay, and finally with David, I just wanted to get a picture of how this system looks when you look at the backlog of people applying for green cards and a continuing and growing stream of people, foreign-born people, coming out of our institutions of higher learning. What does the picture look like for them? What happens if we don't do anything about this? I mean, where does this go?
Well, I think the evidence is that we just continue to muddle through. I mean, what we have is an imbalance between people who come nominally on temporary purposes, but in practice the culture is that you find a way to work your way through the system. And I think the answer is we have a lot of people in limbo, and we don't provide clear signals. Ron mentioned that the H-1B is dual intent. Which means that it could be temporary, it could be permanent, but of course there aren't permanent places for everybody. So the intent is a little bit fuzzy there, I think it's fair to say. So I think we ought to remember that there are people involved here, and it's not just about the economy as a whole, but also about these people. And I think the biggest impact is that they're stuck, those who would like to stay but are unable to. Now, also people go home, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. In fact, it's one of the great success stories of U.S. policy over the 50 or 60 years that it's been in place. So Bob Hamilton mentioned the idea of a positive-sum game here, right? The goal isn't just to accumulate and accumulate and accumulate. There needs to be some balance. But I think we have the policy now, it brings people in without giving clear signals as to what the disposition is going to be in the long run. And I would like to see that sorted out.
All right, now let's turn to the audience. We have a question over here.
Have you looked at asylum immigrants versus the kind of immigrants you addressed in your policy recommendations? My take on your data is that a large fraction of those entrepreneurs were asylum immigrants.
Yeah, we don't have the data for our study on that because we didn't necessarily talk to the entrepreneur themselves in doing the survey. We talked to the company, and we felt it wasn't necessarily realistic to ask the respondent to know what kind of visa the person came in on. But in the interviews, it's pretty clear people are coming as students or as workers. I think there may be some individual cases of the sort that you're talking about, but my own gut instinct is it's a pretty small share, and I think John's data backs that up a bit. Now, the early Cold War period may be a different story than the 1990s.
Right here.
My question is for Professor Hunt. Thank you. I found your study very interesting, but I was wondering if you only did this for the U.S. case, would replicating this, say, for the community of Ecuadorians in Spain, do you think it would produce the same results? Would they publish more, patent more? Have you explored maybe studying that as well?
Well, in the study, I was focusing on people with a college degree or more, so I'm deliberately homing in on the skilled component of immigration to the U.S. Things would look different if I just looked at all immigrants against all natives, because the immigrants to the U.S. are concentrated in the more than college section and the less than high school section, and to some extent, if you were looking at these outcomes, they would cancel out probably. And so in Spain, for example, because it's very difficult, unless you're from the European Union, to move to Spain legally. For example, the Ecuadorians mostly go illegally to Spain and then wait for an amnesty. And the sort of people, so from outside the European Union, the sorts of people who go are people who are willing to work illegally for a while and wait for an amnesty. And so they're not likely to be so skilled. But the reason, there was actually a reason that I looked at the U.S. for this study, though, is precisely because that I think that the U.S. probably does have the best environment for innovation, and the U.S. has been the leader in innovation, and that's why I was interested particularly in immigration to the U.S. and innovation in the U.S. I think it would be more interesting to take a country like, say, Canada, and try and look at the outcomes there, if you were looking at an alternative to the U.S. But I think it's inherently not quite as interesting because Canada is not the leader in innovation. But I also don't know any data that would allow you to do that for Canada. So I haven't actually looked at other countries.
The back of the room, please.
Good morning. This is Jean Lee from George Mason. I have a question for Jennifer. Actually, I enjoy your presentation very much, but I'm wondering if foreign-born and native-born are truly comparative, since even if they're in your research, you say they're from the same field and they're at the same level of education, but since the high-skilled immigrants, they are far away from the average in their home country. So my question is, in terms of productivity, should we compare the high-skilled immigrants to the native-born, or should we compare them to their counterparts there in their home countries? Thank you very much indeed.
Okay, so that depends on what the question is that you want to ask. I think if you want to ask what's the impact on the U.S., then yes, you want to compare them with the people who are here already. If you're interested in what's happening to the home country, of course, then you want to compare to the home country. And if you're interested in the world as a whole, you might want to know both, I think. But you're right that an issue when we say we're comparing similar immigrants and similar natives is whether the observable characteristics really are comparable. So just for example, in many data sets, we don't know where the person has studied, and we say, all right, this is a college graduate from Ecuador, and this is a college graduate from the U.S., and we say that, therefore, they have similar education, but we don't really know how well it transfers to something Jeanne alluded to. In the particular data I use, you actually do know exactly where the people studied, and I find, for example, that people who studied outside the U.S., in terms of wages, get a 20% lower return. But what was very interesting, though, is that it doesn't make any difference for all those other things I talked about, all the innovation and so forth. That was something that very much surprised me. It doesn't seem to be any handicap to have your degree from outside the U.S. in terms of patenting, publishing, and starting companies. And similarly, one of the big reasons, this has been extensively studied in Canada, why immigrants earn less than similar natives is that there seems to be no return to foreign experience at all. So any time you worked outside, outside Canada, it doesn't increase your wage at all in Canada. And again, I find that in my data for the U.S., but again, not, this really surprised me, not for these innovative outcomes. It doesn't, you get the same return to foreign experience as to U.S. experience.
I would just add, it's a curiosity, when you look at high-tech companies, you know, for many workers, they say, well, it's hard to tell who's good and who's bad. But among the very best, they really do believe that the very, you know, there is that one person or one or two people who are really important. So that I heard from a Google board member that when they were starting Google Earth, they found the right designer, the person that was supposed to head the project. He was an Australian. And they were said, well, we'll give you whatever you want to come to the United States. What they could not give him was the permission, the work card for his wife to have a job in the United States. So Google Earth was done in Australia because they believed that once you found the right person, that's what mattered, and that's what would make the difference. Not all companies work that way, but certainly among the entrepreneurial high-tech companies, there's a strong belief that at least at a certain level of the workforce, the individual matters immensely. Let's see. Let me, if someone hasn't had a question yet, in the back in the corner.
Al Milliken, AM Media. What more do any of you know about the higher and lower education preparation of the immigrants you have studied, particularly what they have learned outside the United States? Yeah, I was trying to find out about the preparation the immigrants have had, their studies outside the United States.
Well, in our study, we weren't able to assess the quality of the degree earned abroad or versus in the U.S. But again, from the literature, we know that the quality of education varies out in other countries as well as in the U.S. The degree from Cornell matters much more and is valued much more than is from a smaller university in okay, I'm not gonna give a name, but what was alluded in the earlier session is that employers often have no idea how to evaluate a degree from I'll use my own country from a technical university in Moldova, right? But they might know a Beijing university. So often what happens is that there is an ad hoc evaluation that is happening just based on the knowledge that they already have without a proper system that would quantify and properly evaluate the credentials that were earned abroad and would transfer them properly in the qualification systems in the United States.
Very briefly, and then we're going to wind it up.
Okay. Well, some of what I just said before was relevant to your question, but I'll just say also that some people who are in favor of admitting very highly educated immigrants to the U.S. Say somewhat cynically that it can't be bad for the U.S. to have some foreign country pay for so much education and the U.S. to reap the reward. But I just point out, though, that there is actually a cost to this apparent free gift. which is that the older a person is when they arrive in the U.S., the lower their wage is. Again, not so much for the innovative sides, but for the overall productivity and wage, it has a big impact. I saw my data also. And so there are offsetting effects. The more a person has studied abroad, the older they are. So they're more educated, but that affects their productivity.
All right. I want to give our panelists their chance to leave you with parting words, knowing that all of us have only 30-second brain capacities. They're all going to give you their last words in just 30 seconds, and that'll be their takeaway messages. Start with Ron.
Sure. I'll just hit my key points very quickly again. The public discussion needs to disentangle temporary work visas from green cards, and I think the reality is that companies and business models are way ahead of the immigration policy debate. Which is no surprise, usually in innovation, usually technology policy lags what goes on in terms of the reality of technologies out there. The same thing seems to be happening right now. And so we should really reconfigure the debate around what's really happening amongst companies and what they're doing, at least in terms of work visas and employment-based green cards and what we want in terms of goals, the normative side, or as Jennifer has put it, the objective functions of the various different constituents and stakeholders.
Hey, Jennifer.
I think that Zoltan brought up a good point in the earlier panel. Is there something that's actually not working that we're trying to fix? And I actually think that in this domain we're discussing, with the exception of the big backlog for employment-based green cards, there isn't actually anything that needs to be fixed here that's very major. A couple of caveats, like the indentured servitude problem, which I agree with. But because there isn't anything huge that needs to be fixed, I'm actually opposed to a point system. And I say this partly on the basis of my experience with Canada, but also from my study of who is doing well in the U.S. based on what visa they actually had when they first came to the U.S. And in terms of who seems to be the best unobserved, so if you compare natives and immigrants with similar characteristics and what's left over is actually their unobserved characteristics. It's actually the people who came in on temporary visas who are the best, and those are the ones picked by firms. And I think that firms know best who will work best with firms and not the government.
I would suggest that we have to follow the we have to keep an eye on what other countries are doing. And for example, the way Canada found out that they have brain waste is that they tracked the success and the outcomes of their immigrants longitudinally and found out that over time they're just not doing better. So understanding of what happens to immigrants after they arrive is absolutely key. And which brings me to the point that I was trying to make earlier is that we have to have some sort of an independent agency, commission or committee or whatever you want to call it, that would analyze the economic trends, analyze what happens to immigrants after their arrival, and mesh the two trends in order to bring flexibility in admission levels and the types of visas that are available.
And David?
I guess I'll tell you two somewhat contradictory things. The first is that we need to embed our discussion of high-skill immigration and probably immigration broader in a larger economic strategy discussion. That's one part of an environment that's going to lead to better economic outcomes and other kinds of outcomes for Americans, but it's not an answer. Certainly by itself, it's not an answer. But then the other thing I think that's important to keep in mind, and I'll just repeat what I said earlier, there are people involved. This is what distinguishes this factor of production from all others. So we need to be fair to the people who are involved in this process, and hopefully we can meld those two things together. So,
okay, thank you all for your attention and your interest in this subject.